8th, 2003. A quick note regarding our schedule before we get started. House Bill 3551, we are not going to hear in its entirety. In fact, we are going to move this bill to the Revenue Committee, where we are going to have a hearing on this bill and its companion piece regarding ethanol and biodiesel production being added into the pollution control statute in the Revenue Committee very soon, as we're getting short in our timing, so that we can have all of the presentations regarding the telling us and educating us what ethanol production and biodiesel, how it's achieved and how it can make a difference here in Oregon. We think that that's most likely the best decision to have those hearings in their entirety in front of the Revenue Committee, as the bills would have to go there anyway. So, members, I'm sorry to say that my own bills we're not going to be able to hear in this committee because of the timing conflict. So my apologies that word didn't get out any sooner to those of you who have come here. So we're just going to be moving that bill over there for today. We are going to hear House Bill 2258 first, and I want to get through that very quickly and work the bill, and then we'll have start into our program. Before anyone gets started here, I want to mention to you that if you sign up on the witness registration sheet and you are a government official and a lobbyist, you are bound by the ORSs that govern your testimony as being accurate and truthful. If you are a member of the public at large and are not a government official or lobbyist, this does not apply to you. However, we still want you, obviously, to tell us truthful and accurate testimony. So, having said that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2258. And, Ray, do we have amendments to this bill? We have individuals signed up to testify on this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We do have a -1 amendments. And that -1 amendment specifies surcharges and updates current statutory language. It also removes obsolete statutory requirements, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The chair would like to call Ron Anglin. Ron? On deck will be Jared Broadfoot, and then next will be Ward Armstrong. I understand we have agreement on this bill. I'd like to move it as quickly as possible. Members, our schedule today is busy. I want to move forward as quickly as possible on each bill. Would appreciate, and the chair will try to make note of this himself personally, that we ask only the most important questions and keep our comments and discussion to a minimum so we can move forward. Thank you, Ron. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Krupp, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for ODFW. We understand, likewise, that there has been an agreement reached on the bill, and the department would just like to express its support for that agreement.
Okay, thank you. Jared and Ward. Jared, Ward, you want to come forward? Just move the bill? All right. As introduced, that is correct. So then we don't want the -1 amendments. Okay. Anyone else like to testify? Hearing none, we're going to close a work hearing on, a public hearing on House Bill 2258 and open a work session on House Bill 2258.
Mr. Chair, I move 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Members, it has been moved to move House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Gilman? Yes. Representative Gilman will be the carrier. Thank you, members. And thank you to the individuals who worked on this diligently. We do appreciate your hard work in this regard. Members, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3551. For those who have just come late, we're just going to move this bill to the House Revenue Committee and hear the entire policy issue on ethanol production over there. I would ask your indulgence to do so. The chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 3551 to the Revenue Committee.
Okay. House Bill, members, has been moved House Bill 3551 to the Revenue Committee without recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 3551. Okay. We have Representative Greg Smith here, and we are going to hear House Bills 3125 public hearing and House Bill 3126. And as a courtesy to the representative, come forward, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Croft, with members of the committee, for the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow County. I truly appreciate your leadership today in allowing House Bill 3125 and 3126 to come before you today. I want to take a moment and share with you why I'm here. Back in 1996, the federal government, as part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, decided to reintroduce gray wolves into the lower United States, into Yellowstone National Park and into central Idaho. And back in 1996, 35 gray wolves were introduced into central Idaho. And these wolves have had a chance to grow and to reproduce and are now starting to spread out. And the fact of the matter is they're starting to spread out into Oregon. In the last several years, there's been sightings of the gray wolf coming into Oregon. And the fact of the matter is this spring, these wolves are going to be having pups. And these pups are going to be moving. And chances are they're going to be moving into Oregon. This was an issue last session as a freshman I had brought forward as a result of the Oregon Cattlemen raising this issue with me. And we were able to put a bill on the governor's desk that addressed a portion of the issue. And unfortunately, the bill was vetoed. And so we're now back here again hoping to take another look at this issue and to realize that Oregon does now have a problem. The gray wolf has recently been downlisted from endangered to threatened on the federal endangered species list. And the state of Oregon now has a decision. Do they institute a management plan for wolves when they are coming to Oregon? Do they do nothing? Do they try and work out a cooperative agreement with the federal government and the state of Idaho? They have many options that are before them. I introduced House Bill 3125 and 3126 to try and help set the focus on this debate. What House Bill 3125 does is it directs the Department of Fish and Wildlife to negotiate in good faith with our federal agencies to remove the gray wolf from Oregon. It's a simple bill. It says that the wolves were extirpated from this state more than 50 years ago, and that the wolves pose a direct danger to the Oregon livestock industry, and that the wolves are not currently in danger of extinction. As I mentioned earlier, the federal government has downlisted them. And the state of Oregon simply cannot afford to have the gray wolf come into Oregon. But there's a better use for taxpayer dollars, and that's funding education, our senior and disabled folks, our public safety folks. And so we believe that it's a good use of our time to discuss this issue to try and figure out a way to ensure that the state be proactive on this issue. I also introduced House Bill 3126, which is a much more direct bill. And what this bill says is that it prohibits any person first from releasing a gray wolf onto non-federal lands in Oregon. And it also allows a person to destroy a gray wolf if a person's safety or property is threatened. I want you to understand where my district lies. I represent Union and Wallowa County, which is in the far northeast corner of Oregon. This is rural. This is truly rural. Before redistricting, I had the pleasure of representing District 59, which included Baker County and Grant County, and that's rural. And these wolves are coming over, and they're beginning to have a presence. And we today, as policymakers, have a choice. Are we going to get our arms around this issue now and be proactive, or are we going to turn our head and be reactive? The fact of the matter is we do have an issue, and we have to figure out how to address that issue. I want you to know the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been absolutely fabulous in this process. Director Ball has been very open. He's listened to all sides of this issue. He has held public hearings around the state, in my neck of the woods, over on the coast, throughout the Willamette Valley, and for that I applaud him. I also want you to know I've received a couple letters on this issue. And I'd be more than willing to pass them around to you. Not one of them says, Representative Smith, will you please make sure we keep the gray wolf in Oregon? I'll say that. I want you to know I have a letter here from the sheriff of Wallowa County. And in this letter, he takes a very common sense approach to the issue. He points out the cost it's going to have on not only the state, but also on local government. The cost of trying to manage this population. He talks about the public safety issue of the gray wolf coming into Oregon and the concern he has for the livelihood of the stock growers throughout eastern Oregon. He quotes as the chief law enforcement officer in Wallowa County, he is concerned about the conflicts that will most certainly arise between livestock producers and wolves. Anyway, I won't take up much more of your time. I just want you to know we truly do have an issue before us. We have to figure out how we're going to get our arms around that issue. I hope that, Chair Krupp, you will be proactive in working with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on this issue and all the partners who have a stake in this issue. The fact of the matter is we need to be proactive, and the reason for these bills, once again, is for us to have a tool to be proactive in the management of the gray wolf. So I truly appreciate being able to come here and speak to you today as the representative. The folks are going to be most impacted by the reintroduction. We would say, let's put the gray wolves out of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Members, questions? Hearing none, Representative. You are off the hook today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the chair would like to call Glenn Stonebrink, since you're signed up for both these bills, Glenn? For all three, actually. Well, Representative Butler is showing up. And Representative Butler, you're welcome to come sit on the dais if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just slipping out of public safety, ways and means. So I just want to check and make sure everything's going well with all the bills that the bill needs me otherwise.
Well, actually, Representative, since you're here, why don't you come forward with Glenn at the same time so that we can make economy of time? And the chair would also open up a public hearing on House Bill 3075, since Representative Butler is here. And Glenn, would you be so gracious as to allow Representative Butler? Go ahead, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tom Butler from southeastern Oregon, House District 60. Mr. Stonebrink will let me wear my hat even. He recognizes it's important that we continue to eat beef, and as much as we don't have jobs in southern Oregon. Originally, my bill had requested that that we transfer the oversight for the gray wolf over to the Department of Agriculture, as opposed to having it continue to be administered in the Oregon Fish and Wildlife. That isn't exactly the way that the bill came out, but it basically indicates that for scientific purposes with regard to the endangered and threatened species, that the list would not include the gray wolf, that's the Canis lupus, commonly known as the gray wolf, that animal be removed from the threatened endangered species. And it's my understanding that that's what has happened now with federal legislation and federal action. So I just would leave that for your consideration with the other important bills which you will hear.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this bill I'm also representing the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. In case you couldn't see Representative Butler's cap, it said beef is what's for dinner. Well, we don't have a beef against the wolf, but we don't want our beef to be the dinner for the wolf. 160 years ago, almost to the day, the settlers of this valley came together in several meetings called the Wolf Meetings, and there, I was just handed this article just before I came up. There's a mural in the House of Representatives that talks about the Wolf Meetings. It was actually the beginning of the Oregon legislature, territorial legislature. But these meetings were called the Wolf Meetings for a specific purpose. They were called because some of the verbiage that you'll find in the reports said that the wolves were killing their livestock and threatening people. Now, in my packet that I hand out to you, there's just a small smattering of stories, and these are more recent stories, most of them, that talk about the that wolves not only attack and kill livestock, but they do attack people. As was mentioned by Representative Smith earlier, it started in 1995, then Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt wanted to have an experiment over in Idaho. And so they went into Canada, and they darted and captured wolves and brought them into Idaho and set about a specific boundary for those wolves to live in, because they do have vast areas of wilderness in Idaho. Now, the belief was at the time, and I happened to be working back in Congress as an aide, and so I was in on some of those hearing or discussions, personal discussions with Secretary Babbitt, and he really didn't think that there would be a very significant loss to big game animals or livestock. But the wolf did flourish, and there has been a significant reduction in big game animals and livestock. And we're close partners and have good relationships with the Idaho cattlemen. They can tell horror stories about the wolves and their livestock for 2 or 3 days and other places in the United States as well. So what we did have when those experimental wolves came over to across the river into Oregon, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife had a policy that said we would ask the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to please come and take the wolves back. And they did. The first wolf, the infamous B-45, was captured and taken back to Idaho, because they did recognize that this was an experimental population. There was a specific boundary, and this wolf obviously had crossed that boundary. Now, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot more talk about the wolf, and the Department of Justice has said, well, now wait a minute. The assistant attorney said, he said, how can you be asking for these wolves to be taken back to Idaho when, in fact, Oregon has them listed as an endangered species? And that's a good point. I mean, if we're supposedly trying to protect them, and our Endangered Species Act looks towards a management plan, because that's what we want. When we have an endangered species and we want that species to flourish, then why are you taking back Idaho? So this is what I call the real bone of contention, that actually the wolf should never have been listed to begin with. In your packet, you'll also see two different documents, both from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, that state the wolf had been extirpated from Oregon for over 50 years, and also that Oregon does not have sufficient contiguous wolf habitat of adequate size to support wolves in a year-round basis without livestock damage problems. And in the other document, it talks about land uses, which also refer then to wildlife. Now, Oregon's Endangered Species Act was passed in 1987. So when we think back, in 1987, that's within that 50 years where wolf had been become extinct in Oregon. It had been extirpated. Then we really question, why was it listed to start with? And we go to what was known as the grandfather clause, where all of the species that were listed at the federal level at the time of the enactment of Oregon's Endangered Species Act, they said, well, we will just list them also. But there's a little flaw in that, and there's more species in this, but the most notable ones, the California condor and the grizzly bear, used to also be in Oregon, but were extinct. Those weren't listed, but the wolf was. Another point is that the Oregon Endangered Species Act prohibits the listing of a species that has been introduced. And yet these wolves were introduced from Canada into Idaho. They just moved across the boundary. So they're an introduced species. The Oregon Endangered Species Act says that shall not happen. Oregon Endangered Species Act also states that the burden of protecting and recovering threatened and endangered species can be a significant cost to the citizens of this state. And it is therefore the policy of this state to minimize duplication and overlap between state and federal laws dealing with threatened and endangered species. Now, the wolf is listed presently as a threatened species by the federal government. It really shouldn't have dual protection if we're going to look at our own act. Also, the Oregon Endangered Species Act states that the commission, this is the Fish and Wildlife Commission, may decide not to list a species that otherwise qualifies as a threatened or endangered species within this state if the commission determines that the species is secure outside this state or the species is not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance to the people of the state. I think that's very important. Point number one is that are the wolves are there plenty of wolves in other places? Yes, there are. In Idaho, and it's obvious because they are, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have actually now been eliminating certain packs that have been getting in too close to the populated areas as well as devastating livestock. In Minnesota, when they protected the wolf, they said, well, you know, by golly, when you get 300 breeding pairs in Minnesota, we will delist the wolf. That number was reached 25 years ago, and they still haven't delisted the wolf. So there's an abundance of wolves in other places. And then the second point, if you really look at this and you say to the commission that they may decide not to list a wolf because of its cultural, scientific, or commercial value, and that's any one of those. The word or is in there. So if they find any one of those values are not significant, they can decide not to list the wolf. But the wolf is listed. And I say it's listed more by fluke than by design, because as already been pointed out, the wolf is extinct. And how can you have a species that's both extinct and protected as endangered? And then we look at the cost. The wolf management plan being considered by the Fish and Wildlife Commission would cost between $800,000 and $2 million. And that's based upon what's happened in other states. The Fish and Wildlife Commission has the power to remove the wolf from the Oregon's ESA, but they've refused to do so. It's now up to the people, the representative, that's you, to fix what's wrong and protect what's right by, number one, stopping the release of wolves. That's House Bill 3126 that you're considering today. Number two, negotiate with federal agencies to remove their experimental wolves from Oregon. That's House Bill 3125. And then to remove the wolf from Oregon's endangered species list and declare it as a predator. And that's House Bill 3075. Obviously, there's no one, even the most fond, people are the most fond of wolves, would deny that wolves are a predator. They are a predator. Now, in conclusion, I just want to state that we have been in communications. We've gone forward in good faith to communicate with the governor's office to say, you know, we could say let's not even talk about wolves, and let's not talk about vast changes to the Endangered Species Act if you'll consider one thing. Earlier testimony by the ODF&W, they said that 27 of the 36 now listed species under Oregon's Endangered Species Act. So those 27 came in under the so-called grandfather clause, which says we will just list anything that the federal government listed in 1987. That really the prudent thing to do would be to say, hey, let's remove all 27. Let's just not talk about wolves. Let's remove all 27. And then the proponents of any one of those 27 species that chose to do so could petition, and using good sound science, would ask for the commission to reconsider to have dual protection under Oregon's Endangered Species Act and let them stand on their merits, whether they're worthy of having dual protection or if it's significant, if it's sufficient to have just federal protection. And so I'm asking for your consideration of all three of these bills or any one of these bills, whatever you might choose. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Glenn. I have a question for you briefly. The 27 species, 27 of them were grandfathered in 1987, correct?
That's correct, sir.
And Glenn, it's my understanding that the law on the Oregon Endangered Species Act says that I think there's within 5 years, in fact, maybe Ron Anglin can answer this question when he comes up to testify on this bill, but I think under the Endangered Species Act of Oregon, within 5 years, there has to be a management plan.
Mr. Chair Krupp, I don't know if there has to be a management plan, and again, Ron could probably answer this better. I believe the 5 years, and my eyes can't find it very quickly right now, and I'm looking at the Endangered Species Act, but was for a review, that they were to review all of these species. And again, we believe that was put into the law so that the commission could say, hey, let's review them and determine what their status might be. Well, if we review them and say, gee, guess what? They're extinct. Then a prudent person would say, then why are we protecting them? Why are we going to spend all of this money to protect something that's extinct?
And Glenn, your figure of it cost ODF&W $800,000 to develop the wolf recovery plan, is that correct?
Chair Krupp, these are figures that I heard talked about at the last commission meeting. It may be slightly more than that. My figures of $800,000 to $2 million are based upon what's happened in other states. And most of the time when they say that amount was allocated, when I talk to the livestock producers, they say, and that was never adequate to pay for the loss of both livestock and, livestock, cattle, and other livestock.
Okay. Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glenn, can you give me an estimate of when you say that the wolves pose a direct danger to Oregon livestock industry, how much we're talking per year?
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, I can't to Oregon because Oregon is a little different than the states that we've also dealt with. I can tell you that the $800,000 was roughly what the Minnesota cattlemen said had happened to their cost of their livestock. They have a program where they pay for some livestock damage, but they also said that was never enough. And I'd just like to elaborate why. Is because that's only on proven kills, and it's pretty tough sometimes to prove a kill, and especially like in eastern Oregon where a lot of our ranchers turn their cattle out and they may cover vast areas of 10 to 20, 30,000 acres, and then they gather them in the fall, and all they know is that they've had greater losses than they've ever had before. I mean, that's a scenario, and they'll say, what happened? Well, you can't certify a kill when that happens. And also, you virtually would have to walk around with a video camera with you at all times watching your cattle to actually catch them in the act of killing, because when they kill, they oftentimes, there's virtually nothing left. And then other predators, scavengers come in, and so the evidence is pretty tough sometimes to prove.
Yes.
So you're saying then that there could be other predators causing this depletion in livestock, since it's so tough to prove.
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, we have kills from bear, cougar, sometimes in the cattle industry a coyote, but the only time when I was a rancher that I saw that is when a a cow was giving birth and a coyote started eating on the calf before the calf was all the way out of the cattle, the mother cow. But this is just an additional predator on top of the predators that already are devastated, or that we have to live with.
Thank you.
That's it, huh? Thanks, Mr. Chair. Too much information in that last answer, by the way.
Yeah. Way too much.
What's your sense? From the perspective of freshmen, it seems like ODFW, from my perspective, is pretty balanced, pretty reasonable on a lot of these issues. What's your sense of why they've not taken the action to delist the wolf?
Chair Krupp, Representative Punt. Actually, ODFW doesn't get to make that decision. It's the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So I will assume your question is why is the commission? And I've sat through, in fact, we the cattlemen petitioned and had two hearings last year in 2002 to ask them to remove. And at all times, like most any commission, they turn to their legal counsel from the Department of Justice and say, you know, what's your opinion? Well, commissions and commissioners pretty much have to follow the opinion of the Attorney General's office, or they won't be, you know, they could be considered liable. And in the opinion of the attorney Bill Cook, who was representing the commission at the time, he said that, well, all he would say was you have to have adequate science before something can be delisted. My argument in the petition was never to ask for delisting. We asked for removal. And the difference in the two words is, yes, delisting would require a proof that a species has significantly recovered. But we have an extinct species we're talking about. And so there was never science to put the species on the list, because when you deal with science, it's comparative science. What was the number at a certain point in 1987? Well, it was zero. What's the number in 2002, other than those that may have strayed, was zero. And so we don't have science to start with. We can't produce science for delisting, but we said we wanted to have the wolf removed for the very arguments that I've given her.
Okay, one quick follow-up. You mentioned in your testimony that the associations had some contact with the governor's office trying to encourage the same kind of action. You don't mention the outcome of the conversations. Where is there no outcome? Is it still in process?
Representative Krupp, Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt. Unfortunately, that's the case, because we talked with Jim Myron and then we talked with Jim Brown. We offered our what we thought was a reasonable and a prudent outcome that could be taken. They listened. They took notes. I understand there's been discussion between ODFW and legislators here at the Capitol for a couple weeks now. I've never been privileged to what that says. I would have been happy to have known if there were amendments, and if there was a reasonable outcome, then I would have asked the sponsors of this bill if they would have pulled it, but pulled these bills, but nothing. I'm locked out of that discussion, and as far as I'm concerned, I think these are still prudent decisions to be made by this committee based upon the testimony that I've given you and good common sense to move forward with these bills.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
Jared Broadfoot, you are signed up for two of these bills. Why don't you go ahead and come forward? Welcome, Jared, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot, here today representing the Oregon chapters of Safari Club International. Safari Club International is the world's largest wildlife management and wildlife conservation organization. To these bills, as a reminder, we have a serious predation problem on elk and deer populations currently in this state. Adding another predator to that mix, in our opinion, is irresponsible and also in violation of the specific statute that Department of Fish and Wildlife states in their piece on House Bill 3125, says, in addition, the statutory requirement to conserve native species under ORS 496.012 must be recognized, and public concerns gathered from town hall meetings held around the state should be incorporated into that plan. They are correct. We must recognize ORS 496.012, and allowing a management plan to allow gray wolves or any wolf in this state to breed and to establish a population, is our feeling, would be in a direct violation of that statute. Wolves have been out of this state for 50 years now. I think Mr. Stonebrink hit it just perfectly. That was the first formal government meeting in the state, was to make the decision to extirpate the wolf from this state. We, like I said, we do have a serious management problem. The figure of $800,000 to $2 million for a program for the management of wolves in this state, the question we have is this body willing to take that from the general fund? I don't think so. When we spend this session and all year cutting budgets and looking where we can cut the next million or $2 million, our membership is not willing to spend $2 million on a management plan for wolves. We have management problems with the species that we have currently, and the other place that money would have to come from is from our membership, from hunters. We buy tags, we buy licenses, and that money would have to come from us, from the Wildlife Division. And personally, we have not been asked if we wanted to spend that money, and I can tell you what our answer would be. It'd be absolutely not. We spend our money where we think it ought to be spent to manage the species that we have. We do not have the wolves. We want to make every effort to make sure we don't establish a wolf population in the state. I feel it's, irresponsible for the management of all of our wildlife. When we were over in the Senate hearing in front of Senator Farioli's committee, some members from Defenders of Wildlife spoke to the neat relationship between wolves and elk. And I spoke back to that neat relationship. Yes, it's very neat. Wolves are predators. They eat elk. It's part of our ecosystem. We're not denying that. But like I said, we cannot afford to add another predator to the mix in this state and to let them establish a population. We also ask the question of how would this state want to deal with if we flipped one of these bills around, or any bill around, to require the reintroduction of wolves, and if we only required them in the Portland, Salem, and Eugene area. I don't think we'd have such support for developing a management plan for wolves or any such thing if that was the strategy or that was the take on this issue. Like I said, the hunters, we spend millions of dollars on wildlife management and conservation. We started wildlife conservation in the United States. And we are here to tell you that we do not support the reintroduction of wolves. We do not support allowing the wolves to establish populations in the state, because it's irresponsible management, and we would support these bills. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Members, questions? Hearing none, thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bills 3125 and 3126?
Yes, sir. I signed up, but it was more recently.
There is. Okay, very good. If we could get that, that'd be very nice.
Oh. And Ron Ames.
Yeah, Ron, I'm going to have you testify on House Bill 3075 shortly, if you would, please. And there are several people to testify on 37. We have three bills open right now. I'd like to close two of them as soon as possible. Members, we're not going to work any of these bills today because there are amendments coming to them. We are going to hold the substantive hearings. George, would you come forward on House Bill 3126 and 25? Welcome, and for the record, in fact, you might as well testify on 3075 too, since you're up there, George.
I have signed up for all three of them. Okay. Thank you. My name is George Hutchinson. I currently live in Portland and have for the last 6 months or so. Prior to that, I spent 15 years in the Ashland-Medford area, Jackson and Josephine County. I'm speaking for myself and for the Southern Oregon Forest Coalition, which is about 9,000 people, made up of a variety of land use, conservation, environmental, wildlife, and even a water council and a grange are members of that group. I've heard a figure mentioned today of $800,000 to $2 million. I've never heard that figure from ODF&W or the Wildlife Commission. I went to the Wildlife Commission hearing over in Newport, must have been 2 or 3 weeks ago. and listened to all the testimony there. Two of your members from the legislature were there and told the Wildlife Commission that they were on the right track. To me, the right track is letting the people who are professionals, who have the scientific expertise at their beck and call, who have their finger on the political pulse, there's no doubt about that. They're well aware of the poll that says 70% of Oregonians want wolves recovering in this state. They also, those same 70%, said there should be fair compensation to ranchers and farmers for livestock losses. That makes sense to me. What also makes sense to me is an editorial that I saw in the Oregonian. Now, the Oregonian is not one of my favorite newspapers. I think it's too much to one side and too much to the other side on some issues that I don't agree with it. It's frequently, from my perspective, very much in favor of, completely in favor of the agenda of ranchers and farmers and timber corporations. And I'm somebody that thinks that we ought to have a more natural recovering environment. I'm going to read that editorial. It's a short one, just in case any of you missed it.
How long is it?
Oh, it's short. It's
okay. Thank you.
Short. Now, I wouldn't use necessarily the same language. I thought some of this language was kind of hot, even for me. There's a pack of Oregon lawmakers yet again in hot pursuit of gray wolves, cougars, and bears. Now, you all wouldn't be any members of that pack, would you? This has become a biennial chase in Salem, and it's getting tiresome to watch. Important wildlife policies, such as whether gray wolves will be allowed to reestablish in Oregon, should not be set by narrow, special interests hustling bills through the legislature. The state has a public body, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, ready to do the careful planning and set wolf policy. Lawmakers should know by now the danger of mixing politics with wildlife policy. Oregon has endured a decade of conflict over hunting cougars and bears with dogs. Voters have twice rejected hound hunting. That would be that 70% we're talking about. And yet lawmakers are back again baying about cougars and proposing to override the will of the people. Now comes a spate of bills proposing a shoot-first, answer-questions-later approach to wolf management. Several bills are thinly disguised attacks on the State Endangered Species Act. This isn't how Oregon should answer complicated questions about how to deal with wolves drifting back into the state from Idaho. Polls suggest there's a majority of Oregonians who support the return of wolves if ranchers are compensated for any losses. The Fish and Wildlife Commission has held hearings on wolves around the state and is crafting a wolf policy. The legislature should leash its dogs and let wildlife managers do their jobs. I think that says it as well as I could have. So I'll say thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, George. I just have one quick question. Which poll? When was it taken?
A poll was taken in 1999, and it was a I don't remember the name of the agency that took it, but it was one of the very reputable groups, and I'd be glad, Representative Smith, to make sure you, in fact, I'd be happy to give it to the entire membership of this
committee.
Please, if you
would, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gilman.
George, there is going to be damage from wolves if they're reintroduced.
Probably so.
How are we going to pay for that damage?
Well, right now, Defenders of Wildlife, for example, has taken a commitment to continue the umbrella that they have throughout most of the Rocky Mountain West and compensate ranchers, livestock owners, for certified wolf kills. Defenders has actually said, we will do that. And the reason Nancy Weiss isn't here testifying to that effect to you all again today is she's at some convention that she had to go to, and she is a professional and has to do what her boss has told her to do.
Yes.
One follow-up. I'd like to see what kind of proof there has to be able to receive that reimbursement.
I suspect Ron England could probably tell you exactly that, answer that question very specifically.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, George. We're going to stand at ease for a moment. Okay. We're going to remain open on these three bills. We are going to also open a public hearing on House Bill 2416. As Representative Close is here and has some
final comments for us on this legislation? Yes, absolutely. Come forward.
Thank you, Chair Krupp and committee, for hearing this bill yet again. We have had some research needed to find out if this would negatively impact the Oregon State Police and the forensic labs. I'm having a copy of a letter given to you from Legislative Counsel Greg Chamoff, which clarifies that this bill will not affect them. Basically, he says, and I'll just quickly read a sentence, HB 2416 only provides a definition for the term science where the term appears in the Oregon revised statutes. The term science does not appear in the statutes that address the forensics work of the Oregon State Police and does not appear in ORS 40.415, which provides the basis on which an expert witness may provide an opinion. And then he quotes that. So that clears up the main opposition to this bill. I have spoken to Mr. Chastain, and they are now neutral on the bill, according to what he told me on the phone. So, Mr. Chair, we are hopeful that with the Dash 1 amendment, this bill could be passed.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I really don't have...
Could you state your name for the record, Glenn?
Glenn Sombrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's
Thank you.
Association. Other than that, this has been 4 years in the making to try to get something that will save the public money, not cost the public money. We have, I will just say it, we have wasted a ton of public money on bogus science or non-verifiable science. And from the cattlemen, the livestock industry, we're sure happy to work in water quality issues or any other issues if we just have and be full cooperation. But we want good, verifiable science, that if we are doing something wrong, that we have that behind us, and we can also use that for corrective measures as well.
Okay. And Representative Close, what does the Dash 1 amendment do?
Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair, adds the term scientific means of or relating to science, and it just includes that with the term science.
Okay. Members, questions? Hearing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you for your patience with us.
Absolutely. We're going to close the public hearing for the moment on House Bill 2416. And we have remained open on public hearings on House Bills 3126, 25, and 3075. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 3126 and House Bill 3125? Hearing none, we're going to close public hearing on House Bill 3126 and 3125. We are, of course, open on House Bill 3075. Ron Anglin, would you come forward, please, Ron? Welcome again, Ron, for the record.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. Members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. You'll be having handed out to you information on actually House Bill 3125, 26, and 3075, as well as two other pieces of information. One is a general news release from the Fish and Wildlife Service explaining their position as far as the delist or downlisting of the wolves, and then the other is a two-pager question and answers on some pertinent information relative to today. And on the back side of that is a timeline of what's occurred with wolves up to this point in time since B-45 was first captured in the state back in 1999 up through the current date, and then what our planned future actions are. Chair Krupp, would you like for me to go through each one of the bills and provide testimony on those, or what's your pleasure?
Yes, from the department's perspective, share with us your issues or concerns or support.
Thank you, Chair.
Or non-support.
First, with 3125, there's a couple of different things that we feel it would be important for the committee to consider. First and foremost, that even if the state were required to develop a plan for removal of wolves from Oregon, we would still have to comply with all federal regulations under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And with the downlisting to threatened, they still have general prohibitions on take, and we would have to comply with those. Any effort on our part to capture a wolf or to kill a wolf would require a permit from the federal government. And at least at this point in time, they have informed us that they have no interest in any live capture and removal of wolves from the state, and that any take that would occur would be confined to what could occur relative to livestock damage within their 4D rulings and listings. Currently, our commission is about to embark on a planning process, and in that planning process, I would expect that we will also, according to the state ESA, be defining methods of take that would be in compliance with the federal regulations and comply with their own state law. That's all the testimony I had on 3125 at this time. On House Bill 3126, there are several things that would like to point out to the committee. Currently, the federal government has developed a DNA database for all the original wolves that were released into Idaho, Yellowstone, and Wyoming. Those are available to the states. It appears that this bill would require the department to establish a DNA testing procedure and database. We're unsure of what the cost would to us would be if we had wolves that we, in fact, had to go through that process. I think it's also important to note that we currently have statutes that make it illegal to release any domestic or imported wildlife without a permit from the department. And the department has no interest in issuing any permits for the release of wolves into the state, and is not planning to do that any time in the near future, or at all, rather. We are not interested in bringing any wild wolves into the state to reestablish any populations. There is one thing that we're a little bit confused on relative to the bill. It establishes a set of fines for release of wolves on private lands, and it implies that it would be illegal to do so. But the bill, we can't see in the language where the bill specifically states that it would be illegal to release wolves on private land. And
Ronnie, is that your understanding? Is that one of the points of amendment that Representative Smith is bringing forward, the author of the bill?
Well, that could be. We haven't seen the amendment, so I'm unsure at this point in time.
Okay. That's a good question.
And then finally, it's important to note, as I mentioned earlier on the previous bill, federal regulations still are in place that would govern any take, and we and the public would also have to comply with that. The last bill, House Bill 3075, would redefine wolves as predatory animals and would remove them from the state ESA. This would, as we have testified on previously, this would remove all state ODFW protections from the animal by classifying them as a predator. They would have an unregulated status, unregulated take at that point in time. However, as mentioned earlier, still would have to comply with all the federal regulations that would be in place for the take of any endangered species. In previous testimony, there were a series of questions that were asked that probably have more information on than our testimony on the four bills. One of those was whether mandatory management plans were in fact required during a five-year review of the species. And the mandatory management plans were incorporated into the state ESA when that was revised in the mid-1990s. And it's been our attorney's opinion that that only applied for those species that were listed from that point forward and did not require us to develop recovery or management plans or conservation plans for any of the species that had been listed prior to that point in time, which were, in effect, most of the grandfathered species. So you will see that any species that our commission has listed prior or since that point in time, that the department has gone forward with developing a recovery plan or a conservation strategy would be a more appropriate term, excuse me, for those species. The second question was relative to costs. The costs that have been relayed to you from the other states are a range of values from writing management plans to actual on-the-ground management once wolves have been established in the state and the different activities and actions that those agencies have had to undertake. That's probably a fairly accurate range of values as far as what it would cost for us simply to write a plan. We're unsure at this point in time. We would guess that we're probably looking at the next biennium to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000. I'm looking at ways to fund that from federal grants at this point in time, and we're hoping that those funds will be available. The work that has happened up to this point in time, the town hall meetings, et cetera, those have been funded through the general fund and wildlife diversity checkoff dollars within the agency. There has been some license dollars spent merely from the standpoint of staff time that are on license dollars that have attended those meetings to help facilitate some of the breakout sessions. Another question that was asked is, why hasn't the department taken action to delist the wolf from the current State Endangered Species Act? And Mr. Stonebrink explained that there's a difference in opinion between the delist and the remove. And what our attorneys have told us is, even to remove the list, we would have to show that we can, in fact, meet conservation guidelines as required by the plan, or by the State Endangered Species Act, rather, and we're unable to do so at this point in time. So it would be impossible for the commission to move forward to take wolves off of the state ESA list. And the last question was relative to the proof of kill on livestock depredation. And as mentioned earlier, that can be very difficult. And a lot of times you have an animal that simply doesn't show up, and obviously if nothing comes back, you don't have a clue how or why it really disappeared. Even those that you do have an opportunity to go out on the ground and look at, having done a lot of examination of livestock that were suspected cougar kills, it's a very time-consuming process. You have to be able to get there fairly soon after something has happened in order to be able to, in effect, go through an investigative process to try and determine exactly what it was that killed it. And even then, at times, you cannot make a definitive decision one way or another. But it would require, if our department was involved in that, it would require that we would have to train staff that would be familiar with identifying documented wolf kills, and each type of predator has a style that they use with killing. A lot of other states, the states are involved in that to some degree, but they rely quite heavily on Wildlife Services, federal government, to go out and do that work for them in association with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And, of course, as funding becomes more tight and the risk of loss of funding for wildlife services in Oregon, and the fact that not all counties in Oregon have wildlife services agents, then that also causes a problem relative to being able to go out and document exactly what caused the loss of the animal. That concludes all of my testimony, Chair Krupp, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Worth, and then Representative Nels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, first of all, let me know if the estimate of approximately 575 wolves in Oregon, is that an accurate estimate?
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, to our knowledge, there are no wolves in Oregon at this point in time.
And the staff summary that I'm reading says an estimated 575 wolves and 35 or more packs have been documented in the recovery area at the end of 2001.
The recovery area...
Is that in Idaho?
Chair Krupp and Representative Worth is Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. We are classified within the distinct population segment, but we are not listed within the core recovery area.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then I guess I'm confused as to why we have a bill to remove wolves from the state if there are no wolves in the state.
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, you'd have to ask the ones that introduced the bill. My speculation would be that based on what we had requested previously of the federal government, and what happened with B-45 was that if the wolf wandered over the border from Idaho and could be documented that it came from Idaho, that the federal government would come capture that animal and return it back to Idaho. Since then, in looking further into the state ESA, we've discovered that that probably violates our State Endangered Species Act, that we do have an obligation to conserve the species and develop recovery within the state.
Okay, and final follow-up?
Yes.
So I'm correct in the fact that there's no wolves in Oregon right now, then there is no direct threat to our Oregon livestock industry.
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, we are unaware of any wolves in Oregon at this time. They could be here, but there are no documented wolves at this time.
Thank you.
But it is a matter of record that we have had some straying across the Idaho border, correct?
Chair Krupp, that is correct, and we would expect that we will have more straying across the border.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. England, I think I'm going nuts because previously, we heard of wolves being in Oregon. Now, I believe I just heard you say we don't have any here, but we know we have had them here. But so I'm just asking who's liable for these? I mean, for the damage, for the human life that could be lost, for this small child, who is liable? If Oregon Fish and Wildlife do not take their responsibility and assume responsibility or accountability over it, I mean, is the federal government then liable? I thought, and I have a document here that says, it says no person can release a gray wolf, okay, a non-federal land, but if one just shows up, it says that it's contrary to the federal government's authority to develop and implement wildlife recovery plans for a federally listed species. Prior to that, it says that the State Department of Fish and Wildlife must negotiate with federal agencies to remove wolves from the state entirely. And then, in this conflicting final opinion, it says, requiring state and federal agencies to remove the wolves that disperse into Oregon is not permissible under current state law.
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I think
we
got it.
We need a lawyer. Heaven forbid.
The short answer is that we have to work within the Federal Endangered Species Act guidelines. And the federal government directs what actions can and cannot be taken within the federal ESA. And
okay, so are we liable in that case? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
How about Mr. England?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I would have to defer to legal counsel to answer that. I'm unsure, but my guess is that the federal government, being as they are a federally protected species, is the one that would take ultimate responsibility for those species. But we'd have to check on that for sure.
Especially, Mr. Chair, since we have a responsibility to carry out their program, whatever it is.
Or deal with it,
okay.
Nonetheless. Thank you, Representative.
It can save my sanity to just know the true answer to that.
We will no doubt find it. Ron, a couple of questions from me to you, and then I think Representative Gilman has one. The management plan that you said would spend upwards of $300,000 to write, that the commission is considering. And if you want to do that with grants, that's fine. Has the commission talked about and the department talked about anything beyond that in terms of compensation to livestock owners for damage? And if so, have you put a dollar figure on that?
Chair Krupp, no, they have not. And what we will lay out for the commission at our meeting this Friday will be a process for developing that plan and developing an advisory group that will work with the department and then report back to the commission, working within the sideboards that the commission will lay out in front of that advisory group. And my guess is that we will wait for the advisory group to make recommendations to the commission on whether there should be a compensation plan, how that should be funded, et cetera.
Okay, and one last question from the chair before I go to Representative Gilman. I think you testified that your legal counsel had advised you that it was not mandatory to have to write the management plan for the 27 species that were grandfathered in 1987. It seems to me that if we think it is necessary to have a mandatory management plan and recovery for some species, why are we not having them for all?
Chair Krupp, simple answer is we don't have enough people to do it. We happen to agree that it would be in the state's best interest to do that for all those species, but it's a matter of prioritization, and we have not had the ability to accomplish all of that. The portion of my staff that works on this is the Wildlife Diversity Program. In the early 1990s, it had a multi-million dollar budget. It's now less than $1 million, and is part of some of the budget reduction packages associated with the governor's budget. And as that staff has shrunk and those disposable dollars have shrunk along with that, it has reduced our effectiveness in being able to accomplish some of this.
Okay, so I think testimony was made earlier, Ron, that I think in reading the Oregonian editorial that politics shouldn't play a role in this. But it seems to me that policy should. And it seems to me that I find it odd that we're writing a management plan for $300,000 for wolves, and yet we have 27 other species that are perhaps just as environmentally important because they're listed under the Endangered Species Act, but yet we haven't written a management plan for them just because we don't have money. It seems to me that there is some political considerations being made here in this issue, and I find it difficult to believe that as a matter of policy that it is not fairly applied and evenly applied to all species that are listed. And I'm not saying that directly to you in the department. I'm just making note of that policy and politics are clearly at play in this particular issue, in my opinion. If it costs $300,000 for you to write a management plan for this, is that similar, do you think, what it would cost for you to write management plan for all 27 species? Or would that vary greatly?
Chair Krupp, my guess is it would vary depending on the species and the volatility of the species and the various issues surrounding that. And we've already undergone a fairly lengthy public process with the wolves. Depending on some of those other species, would we have to undergo the same type of process or not? We do have other species that we need plans written for, and we recognize that, and we will be moving forward to do that as we can move them to the front burner.
Okay, thank you, Ron.
In the question and answer section here, It says, Oregon Endangered Species Act currently bans the killing of wolves in Oregon, even if they are in the act of killing livestock. Is that the current federal rule, too?
Chair Krupp, Representative Gilman, under the federal downlisting to threatened in the 4D rules, it does offer flexibility to the livestock owner for the take of wolves that are in the act. The State Endangered Species Act has the ability to mirror that as long as it fits within a conservation strategy as outlined and adopted by the commission. That has not been done at this point in time. So that also plays into why it is important for the agency to move forward here with a planning process that will define how take can occur and will allow us to provide flexibility similar to what the federal government does.
And Representative Nelson, you have one quick question?
Yes, sir. I just wondered, Mr. Englund, are there matching funds or for these programs, federal, state, to make something happen?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, yes, there is. If we're able to secure the funds that we're looking at, there is 25% match, and we would use in-kind services for that. So we would not have to come up with actual dollars to secure those funds. So it would be a combination of existing staff time that would also be involved in the planning process.
And last question, and what would come to the top of the list of the 27? How do you determine which one, is it the one that's most dangerous to people and livestock, or is it the one that might be carrying some strange disease, or...
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, the first thing I would look at is are there species that the federal government has either recently delisted or downlisted or is in the process of moving that way? And do we feel that they are secure in Oregon? And those are the species that once we can show that we feel that they are secure in Oregon, it makes sense to have them off of Oregon's list. We would take that action. And in fact, we've already done that on the Columbian white-tailed deer, in spite of the fact that the federal government has not delisted them yet. We did that about 5-6 years ago because we have been able to meet all the delisting criteria and have been able to establish recovery of that species. So we would move forward on those as we can show that we can meet the recovery needs.
Hey, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You reference delisting, which I understand. For the Oregon ESA, what is downlisting? Is there another category below endangered that's an option under the Oregon ESA?
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, like the federal ESA, we have an endangered and a threatened status. Threatened status is a step slightly below the endangered status. There's really not much difference between the two. Quite frequently, when we get to the point where we could potentially downlist, we're also very close to the point where we could go straight to delisting.
Yes, one follow-up. Thank you. Related to, you described in your testimony and in the press release that went out last month, the whole process for changing the rules. What do you envision the timeline being? You talked about the starting timeline for that, but what do you see as being the end game in terms of a timeline for DOD-FNW and the commission and this advisory group process to reach a conclusion?
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, on the back page of the questions and answers, we've laid out a timeline from actions to date and then down at the bottom the planned future actions, and we're looking to have a final wolf management plan adopted sometime late in 2004. Within that, if there were recommendations that the advisory committee could make to our commission that would fit within our legal mandates, that would allow the commission to adopt OARs prior to a final plan being adopted that would allow take, we would have the ability to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to call Greg Addington, Oregon Farm Bureau. Up deck will, or on deck will be Al Elkins. Welcome to you both. Greg, go ahead, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Addington, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and happy to be here representing one of the narrow special interest groups aforementioned. I want to generally support all three bills, Mr. Chairman. Specifically, my comments will be aimed more to House Bill 3075. I'll try not to go over too much ground that's already been plowed here, but there are some points I do want to make. You've heard about the status of the gray wolf, both federally and at the state level. There's solid evidence that wolves as a species are not biologically in danger of extinction. According to data from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, gray wolf numbers in North America easily exceed 70,000. In 1987, the legislature created the Oregon ESA. At that time, the state placed federally listed species, including the gray wolf, on its endangered list. The listing did not require a careful investigation of whether the federally listed gray wolf was a species that is native to our state, or a thorough discussion whether our state should include the species on its threatened list. It did not include any discussions about the fact that the species had not been here for the last 50 years and what ramifications that might have. Those are both issues that would have been discussed if the wolf were being considered for inclusion in Oregon's list today. The Oregon ESA requires the conservation of a listed species and defines conservation as the use of methods and procedures necessary to bring a species to the point at which the measures provided under the statute are no longer necessary. Such methods include research, census taking, law enforcement, habitat acquisition, habitat protection and maintenance, as well as propagation and transplantation. A recent memorandum from the Department of Justice dated January 31, 2003 stated that when the legislature enacted the Oregon ESA, they amended the statute to prohibit, with certain exceptions, any person from taking or attempting to take any threatened or endangered species. This prohibition applies to any person and to all lands in Oregon, both public and private. The ODFNW is in the process of writing a management plan for wolves in Oregon. However, this does not mean that we will have more flexibility in managing wolves. The federal ESA sets a minimum standard for wolf management, so anything we do here at the state level will have to be at least as restrictive as at the federal level. So the questions that my members ask are, why the unnecessary duplication? What are the costs and potential costs to the state associated with having wolves listed? What is the potential liability to the state for not managing, surveying, propagating, et cetera? There was some talk about how much a management plan will cost the state. I've talked to my counterpart with the Idaho Farm Bureau, and they're estimating that the wolf management plan in Idaho will run between $800,000 and $1 million a year. And then there are other costs. The economic damage that will be done to livestock producers. Those that oppose the bill will be sure to say we are weakening environmental laws and that there are programs out there that will compensate for wolf damage. But that is always contingent on some sort of proof that the damage was caused by a wolf. What about the rancher that turns 200 cow-calf pairs onto an allotment in the spring and is missing 10, 20, or 30 calves in the fall? Who compensates for that? What happens to the compensation program if wolves are completely delisted federally? Will it remain? What about the indirect costs of reduced reproduction, weight loss, veterinary bills for animals that may survive an attack, and the loss of domestic animals? Who pays for that? I would also point out that if the wolf stays on the state ESA list, the state, in my opinion, will bear the burden of defending lawsuits for compensation for takings of private property. If removed from our state list, that burden falls on the federal government. I'm sure you can gather by now our members are extremely concerned about the prospect of wolves in Oregon. If wolves migrating here are inevitable, as some claim, then our view is that the state's responsibility is to take steps that will reduce the burden to any Oregonians that will be negatively affected. Classifying the wolf as a predator would move us one step closer in allowing farmers and ranchers to legally protect their property. Mr. Anglin, even in his testimony just prior, stated that each type of predator has its own style of killing. Wolves, by definition, are predators, and they should be classified as such. Doing so, coupled with a delisting at the federal level, will allow the state to remove itself from the inevitable debate over compensation. By supporting this bill, you'll be taking a proactive step to avoid the inevitable human-wolf conflicts that will arise from the migrating wolves. Thank you.
Thank you. Al, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
For the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Al Elkins representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I echo my colleagues' concerns and Mr. Stonebrink's as well. Our association is concentrating on the inevitability that they will be here and that something needs to be done in relation to looking at how this will affect our wildlife populations. As Mr. Addington has said, they are considered a very big predator, the wolf. We sent a letter to the Department of Fish and Wildlife in December after their workshops, summarizing a lot of what we had heard at the various meetings, and asked 8 questions in relation to predator populations and what the addition of one more predator would do to our wildlife and our wildlife numbers, and whether Oregon's habitat could support another predator, and the concern that we had about any management program or plan being funded by tags and license fees. And that's basically our position. This is just a very basic statement on where we are in relation to all of these bills today and our main concerns having to do with wildlife and wildlife populations. Thank you.
Thank you both. Questions? Representative Nelson.
Wait, so just a quick one, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Have y'all sat down with legal counsel and gotten or ever had a talk about liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
Or who's responsible?
I have not.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in the beginning of all these workshops, we sat down and talked to ODFW's legal counsel about liability and asked them to look at that in relation to all of this that was going on. And I think they have made that a part of, especially in relation to the ESA, the federal and the state. I don't know exactly what their answer is to that, but I do know they are taking that into consideration.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Yes.
I just want to add one thing I left out. I think it's interesting that, I mean, this bill, these bills would have to, if there was a fiscal impact, it would be attached. If we reclassify wolves as predators and that moves their management to the Department of Agriculture, there would be some sort of a fiscal. What I think is ironic is that the reverse isn't true. We don't have a fiscal impact for what happens if the wolf stays where it's at on the list. We don't know what the we're all speculating $800,000 to $1 million to $2 million, but we don't know that because we don't do a fiscal on leaving it the way it is. So.
Interesting point.
Good point.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate it.
Chair would like to call Bob, is it Beshta? Did I say that correctly? Thank you. I try not to massacre people's names because I have a difficult to pronounce one myself.
Oh, it's not there on the podium or whatever we call it.
Thank you, Bob. For the record, state your name, please.
For the record, my name is Bob Beshta, and I'm here representing myself. I've been an educator and in research for most of my professional career working on issues like water quality, riparian systems, hydrology, natural resource management, and what have you. And in recent years, I've had an opportunity to do work in Yellowstone National Park, where there's been a reintroduction of wolves. And for the first time, we've been had a chance to begin to see things a bit differently. The handout I've given you covers a variety of topics, which I've attempted to summarize in some fairly brief bullets, and you'll find that some of these are probably fairly counter to maybe things that you have heard before. And I'm not going to read them to you, but I would like to hit on go through kind of in a very quick summary on these. The issues that often come up are things like human safety, big game losses, livestock losses, public education and stakeholder involvement. And these were the issues that the wolf biologists and others, when they came to the Wildlife Commission, did presentations on this issue. These are the things they said are coming at you in Oregon if the wolves come. With regard to things like human safety, David Meech, a world-class wolf biologist, has indicated that wolves have been in the Boundary Waters canoe area for a long, long time. They've never had a problem. To my knowledge, there have been no deaths reported in North America anywhere from wolves, and so when we look at this issue of human potential impacts on humans, the research, the data indicate not the case. The issue with regard to big game, there's an issue on number of animals as well as quality of animals, and I am not a big game person. But we have found that the elk numbers in Yellowstone have not dropped dramatically at this point. They have dropped by about 15%. A bigger change has occurred, though, in Yellowstone elk, and that is they are changing where it is they are most of the time and how they eat. And so we are seeing, we think, an expression of riparian recovery along some of those systems that probably hasn't been there since the wolves were extirpated some 60, 70 years ago, which brings up an interesting point with regard to how will Oregon fare with regard to wolves. We don't know. They've been gone for essentially the same amount of time. The issue about numbers of animals, I just took the east side numbers. I didn't mean to pick on the east side, but 250,000 mule deer, 60,000 elk. This is a prey base which is certainly significant and likely would work for wolves. The west side has high numbers also, but I didn't have those in front of me. So I'd like to indicate a major point here that if wolves come to Oregon, this is not an east side issue. This is an Oregon issue. Wolves can go on either side, and the habitat is likely in both places. In fact, one of the first attempts at trying to do a mapping exercise indicated maybe some of the best habitat was not in eastern Oregon. It could be in western Oregon. How's that for a shocker?
No. We have a lot of sheep around here that we have a coyote problem.
No, please don't.
Well, there's obviously going to be some places that they're not going to be. Okay. The concern and issues about livestock depredation, again, this is not a place that I feel like I'm an expert in. I just went and took data that were available. Wisconsin has, and it's not the best analog, has 250 wolves. The person that has been heavily involved in that program indicated they have 7,000 farms, yet in the state, 4 to 5 farms each year have an issue or a concern. So 4 to 5 farms out of a total of 7,000. Recently released figures by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming indicate 25 cattle a year were killed by wolves. All right. So these are numbers that are out there that can be substantiated or whatever. There's another concern or another issue that I've never heard livestock owners talk about. That is, I'm sure they're concerned about crop damages from big game. And if ungulate numbers drop, it seems like that number would drop. There's another thing that goes on also. When the wolves came into Yellowstone, the coyote populations began to plummet. And I believe they're about 50% of what they once were. So if this is another predator of concern, there's some compensations that may be taking place if you bring wolves back into the system. The fourth issue I identify here is the one with regard to education and so on. And I'd have to indicate that ODF&W has done a wonderful job along here. And as we move forward, my encouragement is that we continue to use science-based information to understand the issues and put those all on the table so that everybody can see them. I'm going to respond very briefly to a comment, why would we do a management plan for wolves, perhaps, and not other endangered species? And I really can't answer that one, but the first thing that comes to me is that wolves are considered what we call a keystone species in ecosystems. That is, they are very important kinds of animals. And for that reason alone, perhaps, they warrant special attention. You may have other reasons why you would or would not want to do a management plan for them versus other species, but that certainly is one that would come perhaps to the top of the list. There's a fifth component, and that's the one that I've been working in recent years, and that's these environmental trade-offs involved with regard to the presence or absence of wolves. When we took wolves out of Yellowstone National Park, we essentially shut off woody species, deciduous woody species, from recruiting in those riparian systems. Since the wolves have been back, we've seen a recovery of that. We begin to see birds in riparian zones. We're seeing beaver back in the system. Okay, these are all in the very initial stages, but the point is that there are some very strong ecological signatures which may be attached to the presence or absence of this keystone species. And it's an opportunity for Oregon to again experience, or it's an opportunity that could be foregone, depending upon where we decide to go. There's a lot of land in the state. Half of it is in federal ownership. More than half is in federal ownership. Somewhere, it seems like there might be a place for a wolf to maybe make a home. I'd like to come right down to perhaps the last couple of points on the bottom of page 3. And I would like to, again, recognize, like others have, the action or the efforts that ODF&W has undertaken so far. As far as I'm concerned, they've done a magnificent job trying to get ahead of the curve on this issue. They have brought in some of the most knowledgeable people on this issue that you could ever put together. Top-notch, world-class experts. If you want to talk about a science-based approach, I would give them high marks for it. They also went to the public in a fairly substantial way, asking their opinions. And I would have to indicate we're all probably in the opinion business at this point in time again, because we haven't had this predator around for a long time. How do we really know what wolves or will not do? How do we really know where they'll end up? So there's this huge learning curve and, a lot of opinions. The last concern is the one really why I'm here today. And that's the move here, I guess, that I see with regard to legislative efforts in Salem. The three bills here, maybe more, I don't know. I do not track this process, that are currently in the legislature seem to me to be a very counterproductive process that's undergoing here. ODF&W currently has a process underway in which they are trying to address, trying to understand, trying to think about this whole issue of wolves. And I think that process should be allowed to come to fruition before the legislature gets heavily involved. I couldn't agree more with the editorial that the Oregonian apparently had out, and I had not seen that before. So if for the legislature to mandate things like the classification or status of a keystone predator before all the facts are in, before all the issues are aired, and before a statewide habitat assessment has been completed, I think is incredibly poor policy for Oregonians. I would also indicate that both they and the wolves deserve better. I thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Quick question. You do mention in your, under your first page, mm-hmm. On paragraph B about human safety issues, no documented wolf-caused mortality. You do talk about there have been no documented attacks upon wolves or upon humans by wolves in the Rocky Mountain and Upper Midwest wolf recovery areas, correct?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
It's possible there may be a couple. I have not seen anything to my knowledge to indicate that that's the case.
There is... Glenn Stonebrink, and if there's a copy of this, you should make it. You should pick up a copy of it.
Okay.
From the Cattlemen's gave us his last page here lists a number of attacks that have occurred and the news stories and the dates of them. They are not from, as best I can understand, the two areas that you've listed in your testimony. They are, however, from Alaska, British Columbia, Toronto. Another one from Alaska, Algonquin Provincial Park. Those are the ones that are here. There is one here, Salmon, Idaho resident Tim Sundles and his wife were attacked. That's in the Cascade Cattlemen, March 2002, and there's a website there where you can read about that.
There is a summary document that the state of Alaska has put out on this issue of wolf attacks, and that's maybe where some of that has come from.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, would you agree that based on these accounts anyway in the newspaper that there clearly is some evidence that wolves do attack human beings.
They may. Let's suppose they do. I guess we're looking at the trade-offs, and if we're after the issue of zero risk and zero tolerance, then in essence, if a single wolf attacks a single person, and if that's unacceptable, then we're at the point of zero tolerance, and that's the issue that concerns me. When I look at risks on one side, and I look at opportunities on the other, it's obviously a balancing act involved here. When I look at ecosystem kinds of processes and things that can happen, again, we've got fish that are threatened endangered species in this state. Okay, one of the issues there is aquatic habitat. If I can improve aquatic habitat, crazy as it may seem, by bringing wolves back in, is that not a plus? How do we balance that off? I mean, this is really where you're at. But what I'm encouraging you folks, as well as ODF&W, to again make sure you get heavily involved in the science. The science isn't perfect, the facts may be imperfect, but they're coming and they are moving forward and they're in front of you.
Doctor, talking about that point that you just brought up in paragraph F of yours, I am confused. Relate for me how the introduction of wolves can help the recovery of riparian plant communities.
Well,
and bringing other species in.
This is 3 years ago, I would not have given you a plug nickel for a wolf in Yellowstone National Park and their role in riparian ecosystems, right? I've been doing research over there looking at the Lamar River. I've been involved looking at the vegetation to try and understand the river. And again, the thing that it was really began to come out of the research was, since the wolves were extirpated, cottonwoods can't reproduce, cannot recruit. That is, they can't grow. We got seedlings everywhere, but they can't get above the browse line. We got elk basically browsing these seedlings all the time. All right, we move wolves back in. Elk numbers are within 15%. If you took the 5 years prior to wolves and you take the most recent 5 years, we've dropped 15%. But most of that happened in some really nasty winters. It was not direct wolf predation. Numbers came down by 15%. Yet we're beginning to see now cottonwood recruitment initially starting. Willows are definitely underway, and we're bringing beaver back. Because for the first time, elk do not sit around in these bottoms all year round, or at least in the wintertime, and browse these plants. So we're hopeful, we're looking forward that we may see quote-unquote riparian recovery taking place. And whereas we've had loss, and almost an entire loss of riparian vegetation for, again, almost 60 years in a national park, in the granddaddy of all national parks. Pretty interesting.
Well, that wouldn't have anything to do with the forest fire we let burn there with no control for several days, I think.
The fire is an independent issue, but in this case doesn't relate to what we're seeing in the riparian systems. No.
One last question. In looking at the Yellowstone issue and wolves there, Were you able to do any research on the adjoining private rangelands or public rangelands about cattle kill, cattle predation by the wolves? Do you have any numbers for that?
No, I'm not. I do not have numbers.
Fair enough. Thank you. Hearing no other questions, thank you, Bob. Appreciate your testimony and for providing us with copies of that. Roger Huffman, ODA, and this, I believe, is our last individual signed up to testify, unless someone else has signed up recently. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Chairman Krupp. For the record, my name is Roger Huffman, Administrator of the Animal Health and Identification Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Within that division is the responsibility to administer the ORS 610 statute, which is the predator statute. For clarity, those animals that are in there, the predators that are defined are obviously wildlife species. The responsibility for populations still remains with ODFW. It doesn't come to the Oregon Department of Agriculture just because they're a predator under that statute. I guess for an example, I can quote like the Washington ground squirrel, which is a rodent, and all rodents under that predator statute are technically can be taken, but ODFW took action to protect that in certain areas, and they can do that. So the same thing could happen if a wolf was put under there. It could take some protective actions or any other of the wildlife species under there. But if it's causing problems, essentially it's a self-help statute for the landowners and livestock producers. If they want to get rid of them, they can. If they don't want to, they can certainly let them be and prosper on their own property as much as they would like. But that would come under that. There is a fiscal impact that we put. It's small, and of course it would grow over time. If we have no wolves now, at least there's no documented wolves. There's 40-some reports that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has of people sighting wolves in Oregon this past year. But there's no confirmed because nobody's confirming those sightings, and they do move quite rapidly. So the fiscal impact, again, talks with having the Wildlife Services, the professionals that deal with predators, help manage those species when there's livestock losses due to wolves. We also issue permits for the private property owners to take some of those species using aerial means. So that is one reason that the fiscal impact is on there, because we do that on an ongoing basis now for coyotes, on an as-needed basis. Obviously, the flexibility, Oregon Department of Ag would like to see as much flexibility as possible. Of course, the federal guidelines, we understand, guide this right now while it's still threatened. Once they're delisted, we want as much flexibility as our landowners can get to deal with the problem, if it is a problem. I guess I would like to also comment that there, as being part of some of the task force, since B45 came here, the Wolf Information Group, I have not seen where there's been a commitment by the Defenders of Wildlife to compensate landowners or property owners for the loss of damage after the wolf is delisted. There is in those areas where they're still protected, and they have extended that hand to Oregon currently while they're still protected. But I think that's an appropriate question to ask them after the delisting, what would happen there. And I'm not going to speak on that behalf, but I have not heard that after delisting of a plan for compensation. The state ESA has stricter guidelines this time, and we're working with ODFW and the commission and stuff to try to get it where there's some flexibility. So with that, I know you're short on time, and I'll button it up.
Thank you, Roger. Questions? Hearing none? Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for your indulgence today, all the members of the audience. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3075? Hearing none, thank you all very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3075. Is Representative Smith close by?
I will have to go find her.
Okay, why don't you find her? The chair would like to take a five-minute break.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it be possible, while you have this brief break, that I might have opportunity to vote on the two bills I missed?
Absolutely, Representative. We'll need to suspend the rules to do that.
I move that we suspend the rules.
Ooh, thank goodness. Thank you.
Okay. Members, it has been moved that we suspend the rules. Any discussion? Any objection? For the purposes of Representative Nelson voting on House Bills 3551 and 225 out, hearing no objection, the rules are suspended. The chair would like to, we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3551. Representative Nelson, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3551, open a work session on House Bill 2258. Representative, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Nelson votes aye. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2258. Thank you, members, for your indulgence. And we're going to take a short five-minute break. We'll be returning with a work session immediately on House Bill 2416. And then we will be moving to a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3552 next. So we're going to take a short break.
We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2416. The chair will entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt one.
Okay.
We adopt the Dash 1.
All right, members, it has been moved that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Discussion? Hearing none, any objection? So ordered. Chair would entertain a motion to pass House Bill 2416 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move we pass House Bill 2416 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, members, it has been so moved. Discussion?
Representative Hunt, may I just ask?
Absolutely.
It's several weeks since we've discussed this, and I can't remember what I said on the record then or not.
You said yes.
Well, it's best to be silent now.
I remember.
You remember.
Yeah.
Well, after four times.
I think clearly there's no question. I think that there are some challenges with enforcement of statutes in a lot of agencies. I just don't see it as the legislature's role to be imposing a definition of science, especially one that is as small and restrictive as this. So that is why I will not be supporting this particular motion.
Thank you, Representative. Always appreciate your thoughtful comments.
Well, I could make a statement, too. I remember the last time we did talk about this, I said that a good portion of the committee had the opportunity to study this issue before and probably knew more about it than I do. But coming back to it, I still don't feel like I've gotten to the point where I think this is needed at this point in time. So I am going to be a no, too.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I think this is one giant step for mankind.
You're plagiarizing now, Representative.
I am. Oh, but I made it.
That was said by someone else before 1968.
But they were on. Weren't they on another?
They were on a different planet. That's true.
But I'm on the planet Earth.
Sometimes they accuse us of being on a different planet.
But I think it's awesome. And just like we said, even if it turns out to not be exactly, we've taken one step to attempt to bring some credibility to what we do. And I thought it was very impressive to me that, you know, it's the state police or the forensics or anybody really did not have a problem with it. So that was one of everybody working together, pulling together to do this. And I want to commend you for the leadership.
Thank you, Representative. No further comments. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
No.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes, sir.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Warren?
She's excused.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Chair Crump?
Aye. House Bill 2416 is hereby passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Members, thank you very much. The chair has to go for a quick meeting with the speaker and is handing the gavel to Representative Gilman, who will be opening a public hearing on House Bill 3552.
Mr. Chairman, would Representative Close be carrying this bill?
Yes. Thank you very much. Representative Close will be carrying this piece of legislation. Thank you both for reminding the chair.
I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3552. A little summary.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3552 allows forest landowner to apply to the State Forestry Department and enter a long-term plan if the restrictions imposed by the Oregon Forest Practices Act or certain administrative rules would restrict harvest on more than 10% of the total acreage. It allows the department to purchase conservation easements and creates a forest practices conservation enhancement subaccount within the State Forestry Department account. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have a Dash 1 amendment that I just received during this hearing. I'll go ahead and pass out. Christina McNitt, who is from the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, is the individual qualified to speak to this amendment and the technical aspects of the bill before you.
And Christina, you're first up anyway, so come on up.
Did you
do we have amendments?
Right here. I'm trying to find the bill.
Copies of the bill.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I know it's been a long hearing already, and I will try to be somewhat quick. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. With me to my immediate right is Sarah Lyman, also a member of the Small Woodlands Association, and Gary Springer to my far right. And I'm very excited to have them here to testify to this bill today. I'm going to keep my comments brief and hit the top lines and have them get into really the philosophy behind why the bill is before you today. I think that staff is passing out a copy of my testimony, and attached to it should be a hand-engrossed version of the Dash 1 amendments. I will qualify that, however, by saying that this is what we put together to submit to council. I'm not exactly certain that this is verbatim. What came from council, Brendan McCarthy told me that he changed a little bit of the language with respect to the landslides. I think that the intent is the same, but the language might be just a little bit different. With that, I will kick off. House Bill 3552 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, basically in an attempt to address a concept around setting some sort of a maximum regulatory threshold, which, if exceeded for an ownership, would allow an alternative process to achieve the purposes of the Forest Practices Act. House Bill 3552 establishes that in the event that provisions of the Forest Practices Act restrict the harvest of timber on more than 10% of the total acreage held in a single ownership, that the landowner may apply to the Department of Forestry to collaborate on the development of an alternative long-term plan. In no instance will such a plan supersede Forest Practices Act regulations on harvest restrictions in landslide hazard locations designed to provide for public safety. In the event that development of a long-term alternative plan is not a viable option, House Bill 3552 does a second thing, and that is it establishes the Forest Practices Conservation Enhancement subaccount. This is an account that's established, but it does not receive any funds. The subaccount is set up for the purpose of receiving, however, private donations, grants, federal funds, and other monies which may be used to provide other incentive measures or purchase conservation easements. I would like to make clear in the record that House Bill 3552 is drafted not to weaken the Forest Practices Act. Rather, it's a recognition that the Forest Practices Act does not affect all landowners in a proportionate way. Some smaller parcels that host a riparian area, for example, may be unduly restricted relative to the same restrictions placed on a larger parcel. The Small Woodlands Association looks forward to working with interested parties in fully developing language to meet the goal of providing some alternative management option for landowners that would, in effect, be designed to result in the same effect or to meet the same purposes as the FPA. And with that, I'd like to turn the baton over to Sarah Lyman for her presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Lyman. Who am I, anyway? My mother's father came to Western Oregon from Minnesota in 1900-something. He set survey corners out in the woods, cruised timber, and bought forest land when he could over many decades. My mother's tenure began upon her inheritance in 1956 and 1963 as her parents passed on. We were absentee owners and mostly passive until about 1978 when my generation got cracking. I've been involved in all aspects of management since then, from planting seedlings to logging to preparing tax returns. I did not grow up at Grandpa's knee, but have learned as I went along. Our family now has forest land in Lane, Lincoln, and Benton counties, and proud of the fact that we have more or less the same volume of standing timber as we had in 1978 and have harvested almost every year. We are trying to remove only the timber volume we grow. My family expects the tree farms to produce net income and continue to support four family groups and two nephews in three generations. We have contributed significantly to our economy and to our governments through the production of raw materials and the payment of taxes. Who are we, the family forest landowners in Oregon? I'd love to paint you a picture of the typical Oregon small woodland owner. I can't do it. We come from every walk of life, from different professions, different politics, different backgrounds, and from rural and urban experiences. We are diverse, but we share our love of forestry and the outdoors. For most of us, the trip to the tree farm is the best day in a week or a month or a year. We own 16% of the forest land in Oregon, some 4.5 million acres, or 44% of the privately owned forest land in Oregon. There are about 50,000 of us who own more than 10 acres. Okay, where are we and what do our lands look like? As a result of early settlement patterns, non-industrial forests typically occupy lower stream reaches and lower elevations. These are significant ecological zones in our state. They also tend to be near expanding urban and suburban areas and provide valuable components of open green space. Our small private woodlands are forests of varied conditions due to our own or previous management practices. You may find young timber or old timber, a small clear cut here, recently replanted there, hardwood and brush patches, single species stands and mixed species stands, well-managed and mismanaged and intensively managed and not managed and semi-managed. Our lands dissect the landscape, breaking up large blocks of industrial and public forest land. This creates a complex pattern of mixed ownership. We simply don't follow one-size-fits-all management schemes. We buffer the extremes of public and industrial land management. Our strategic location and management diversity makes family forest lands of immense economic and environmental value across the landscape. Our working forests are valuable to the state and to our communities. Research recently done in the South found that those areas with a mix of forest ownership types and sizes tend to support economically healthier communities better than do areas dominated by large ownerships. Our diverse ownerships mean diverse objectives, practices, and outcomes, all of which contribute to the community well-being and resilience. What are our management practices? Some smallholder owners and their families do all their own work, from planting the tree to logging. Others use contractors and just oversee the activity, and others use consulting foresters to help them. There's much other work and costs to keeping a working family forest going. We invest tremendous amounts of money and often sweat equity into our properties, many times with no expectation of return for decades and decades. From the time we plant a tree, it may be 30 or 60 or 90 years before our harvest income is realized. Most of us do expect that someday we will receive a financial return for our investment, be it from timber harvested or from the increased value of the property due to a vigorous tree stand. Even those who say now that their primary reason for owning land is not to harvest often find themselves in need of harvest income due to family crisis or cash flow needs down the road. What are our challenges? A great concern to me is the shrinking of our family forest lands by law, regulation, and governmental control. An owner's property can be reduced in effective size without sale or subdivision, but by mandating areas of the property as non-working in no-touch conservation zones like extended riparian buffers and wildlife protection circles. Most of us would like to, quote, do the right thing where our land is concerned. We want to leave the land in better shape than we found it, and we are concerned about long-term productivity. Most landowners agree with baseline conservation measures once we have knowledge of them and why they are important. We also tend to agree that regulations have gone beyond the baseline responsibility for the landowner and have come to a point where the cost of conservation should be shared with other citizens. As my friend Bill Arsenault says, our federal and state governments continue to confiscate our private forest lands, seize our marketable assets, and reduce our income by taking our land out of production, all without compensation, end quote. It can be particularly devastating to small landowners with the poor fortune to have wonderful streams or great endangered species habitat. Rather than be rewarded for doing a good conservation job, we are penalized by losing our lands to wider buffers or to wildlife refuge circles. A 20-acre set-aside on a 40-acre tract is a whole different animal from a 20-acre set-aside on a 2,000-acre ownership. I get asked, people ask me, It's private property. Doesn't the government have to pay you or help you for these set-asides? No, it does not. We have stands of 50-year-old timber that have scattered larger and older trees. When the land was logged over 50 years ago, these bigger trees were not logged. Now, should I leave these trees as legacy trees to attract species like spotted owls? What is my reward if I do attract a spotted owl? No harvest, no payment, I've just created a park. That is not a reward nor an incentive to leave those big trees. I'm doing it anyway, but I think I'm kind of crazy. Policies that require or encourage set-asides to the tune of tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost value, and which may take 20 or 50 or 90% of the family forest out of the working category, may doom the small operation. At some point, we get below a viable size, and our careful, sustainable management plan is disrupted for good. We give up or sell out or cut over. Should we take our chips and open up one more mini mall? Does that contribute more to our community than a working family forest? I can't believe it does. Our family has been up close and personal with Forest Practices Act rules regarding threatened and endangered species. We traded the U.S. Forest Service a parcel located near spotted owls and marbled murrelets, which had been purchased by Grandpa in 1929. One of the properties we got in the trade a couple of years later turned up with a bald eagle's nest. Mm-hmm. We tried to do the right thing, but hopped out of the fire and into the frying pan. Our challenge is to strike a balance that preserves working family forest lands. House Bill 3552 sets a path to establish this balance. To quote Oregon's former governor, John Kitzhaber, he said, "As we formulate policies and ask landowners to do their part, we must understand that securing a healthy environment for our children and grandchildren depends on economically viable land management." Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Yes.
Anna. Thank you, Chair Gilman. Thank you for coming. I have a couple questions on the bill. Christina, could you answer them maybe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I would be happy to do that, but perhaps if Mr. Springer did his presentation, that might answer some of the questions
okay.
as well.
Sure.
And we're not gonna work this bill. We're gonna appoint a committee to work on it anyway, and it's gonna be back in about a week.
Oh. Okay.
Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe that the Department of Forestry has some interest in working with us on wordsmithing some of the language on the concepts in this bill, and we're happy to sit down and do that.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Springer. I'm a family forest landowner. I live in Corvallis, and I help manage our family tree farm of about 600 acres in the Coast Range, about 45 minutes west of Corvallis. I also work part-time for Starker Forests in Corvallis, another family forest land owning group, large by family forest land standards. They manage about 65,000 acres, mostly in the Coast Range as well. I first got interested in forest practices, regulations, and involved in these kind of issues, I guess it was about 1990. I followed the last really major rule changes to the Forest Practices Act, the stream rule protection changes that were occurring then. And at the end of that process, we ended up with some new rules that required landowners to leave a substantial amount of trees alongside of fish-bearing streams and riparian areas when they harvested adjacent stands. And I remember at the end of that process listening to former State Forester Jim Brown make the statement that we have gone about as far as we can with regulation on private forest land. That's where I think the first light clicked on for me anyway for the emphasis behind this bill that's before you today. Jim recognized back then that private forest landowners had been regulated considerably under the Forest Practices Act. They had been a partner in those regulatory changes and had been supportive of the Forest Practices Act, but he recognized it was time to make a change to one of the most regulated land uses in the state. The percentage of ownership that we came up with in this bill of 10%, the idea for that also came from Jim Brown. In the last couple of years, I've listened to Jim several times talk about this. He had the idea of putting a regulatory cap on the Forest Practices Act and switching to incentives as a way to motivate people to do things, conservation things above and beyond where the Forest Practices Act at the time. And the percent that Jim had come up with was actually 9%. And his reasoning behind that was to tie it to the state income tax rate. His philosophy, his thinking was our state income tax, 9%, that's what us individually as taxpayers pays to the betterment of the good of the whole. And so that could be a similar goal for landowners and their obligation to protect public resources. And above that, somebody else should help pick up the tab. What House Bill 3552 does, it sets a cap on Forest Practices Act regulation so as to move increased protection beyond the threshold into an incentive-based process. It gives the Department of Forestry and the landowner options to increase public resource protection beyond the 10% threshold in ways less costly to the landowner than the imposition of new rules. Much like the intent of the alternate plans that we have within the rules today, in fact. It establishes a non-general fund funded account to help pay for protection above that threshold. It draws a much-needed landowner obligation line and establishes regulatory certainty with regards to the Forest Practices Act rules. It legally protects the working forest land base to ensure that the majority of that land base continues to contribute return on investment, wood products, and tax dollars. In that sense, this bill is actually revenue positive in the long term to make sure we keep that working base going. And I think that's just a critical issue given what we've seen, the changes we've seen on federal lands and the reduction from the wood products pipeline that has occurred on over 50% of the forest land base in the state. Finally, what House Bill 3552 does, it applies only to the portions of the forest ownership that the Forest Practices Act rules clearly restrict harvest for the primary purpose of public resource protection. It doesn't cover everything in those rules. It doesn't cover, for instance, wildlife trees that are left behind in a clear cut occurs. It includes those clearly measurable areas, such as riparian areas, where the vast majority of what can be grown there in the way of trees gets left behind by the landowner at harvest for protection of the stream. What House Bill 3552 does not do, it does not reduce the current protection standard of the Forest Practices Act. It does not allow harvest of areas designated as high landslide hazard locations and currently harvest restricted to protect human safety, as Christina told you. It does not apply to federal laws or Oregon's land use laws, only to the Forest Practices Act regulated practices. It does not require general fund compensation if the 10% threshold is exceeded. It sets up a fund that is designed to attract other funding for that. I recognize that there will be real challenges to establish and fund the new Department of Forestry subaccount and also to administer this bill. I would be happy to work through those issues with the department so that this can go forward. In summary, then, I would say House Bill 3552 is not just another regulatory takings bill, which this body has seen plenty of, I'm sure. It's a mechanism to shift added protection from regulation to incentive.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank this team for doing this and bringing this forward. I think it's very good timing. I mean, we need to move on in our forestry practices right now, and I appreciate the concern for the environment, and I also appreciate the fact that many patches of land wouldn't be used for anything if it weren't for all the small woodlanders who took the risk. And thank you for turning bad soil into a great natural resource.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Lanny Quackenbush.
Good
Welcome, sir. For the record, state your name.
My name is Lanny Quackenbush. I am with the Oregon Department of Forestry in the Forest Practice Program. I had myself all primed to say Chair Gilman, and suddenly I look up. And
but you're flexible. You could certainly recover.
I'll try not to call you by the wrong name.
And they look exactly alike. You can't tell them apart.
I ask not to have to respond to that.
And you can't.
Chairman Krupp and members of the committee, I am here on behalf of the Department of Forestry today. And you're receiving our written testimony on this bill now. We are in support of the principles that are set forth in this bill. And our agency has proposed bills similar to this in the past. In fact, I'm kind of learning, but I understand that a bill that was introduced once before actually passed and then was not signed by the governor at that time. And I can't tell you what was behind that, but I just learned today that that had happened.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, briefly.
Yes, Mr. Quackenbush, if you find that out, would you let us know what that was? Would you mind? Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate a copy of it, too.
Okay. We believe, as you've heard from the forest landowners themselves, that there is a responsibility for them to ensure protection of resources, but that there should be some type of an upward limit that a single landowner is asked to economically provide to the citizens of this state. A percentage limit is consistent, as I've noticed in my letter, with emerging international efforts. It's my understanding that in the country of Finland, there is similar provision that if you are asked to give above a certain level, that there is a cap. So that is one of the basis for our wanting to bring this forward for discussion here. And we do note that, as written, this bill applies both to the small landowners that you have been hearing from, as well as the larger landowners or potentially the industrial landowners. And we support this approach as well, because we don't believe that any private landowner, regardless of their class, should necessarily be expected to set aside more or a larger percentage than any other group. We are concerned, however, when we enter into the ideas of this type of a limitation applying statewide for all landowners, that it would become very complex and costly to analyze. And for that reason, we have suggested that maybe there should be some other limitations in this. And we have tossed out some areas of geographic limitation, contiguous ownership by individual watershed, or, in my opinion, even an administrative unit such as an operating circle designated by the landowner might bring this down to a more manageable size from an administrative standpoint. The bill, we want to recognize that as it is written, would make it impossible for a landowner to manipulate their harvest design to qualify for exemption, if you will. But as we talk about changing the scope in terms of geographic area covered, we need to make sure that that is protected and that there would be adequate assurance that a landowner couldn't manipulate, if you will, a harvest design to bring it over the 10% and therefore qualify for other options. The biggest concern that we've got, and kind of skipping down, is how this will interact with other bills, such as the Federal Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, both federal and state removal fill laws. For all of these, the Forest Practice Act kind of serves as the overriding compliance mechanism. And if we change that level of mechanism, we need to be very cognizant of what impacts that might have in terms of the landowner being not taken to or accused of violating those other acts, and particularly in the case of the current ongoing litigation, our agency is concerned that we, the state forester, would not be exposed also to third-party takings claims under the Federal Endangered Species Act for the decisions that we might make in negotiating and agreeing to a long-term management plan. I think with that, I'll leave it to our written testimony and respond to any questions that you might have.
Thank you, members. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. I guess I just need to read through this and think through this, but I had a question. In my district, the National Scenic Act prohibits the cutting of trees of a certain size, et cetera, et cetera. Would this qualify under this, the National Scenic Act?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. We're looking at various other impacts. As I mentioned, Endangered Species Act, federal Removal Fill Act. I could give you a response off the top of my head, but it might be wrong.
You just add it to the list.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's what I want to do with this. We're not going to move this bill today. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have the interested parties, Department of Forestry. I'm going to charge you and the Small Woodlands Association and the Governor's Natural Resource Office to get together and work on this and come to some conclusion as to how we can make this a viable concept within the next. I'm going to ask you to do it by Thursday. If you can't do it by Thursday, I want it done by Tuesday. Okay?
Mr. Chair, I just gave him a week.
Well, I just shortened it.
Okay, he didn't say which week.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's what I want you to do. Let's get at it. Thank you very much. We are going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3552, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2893. Ray, you want to tell us what this bill does?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes. One moment. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2893. We want a little bit of housekeeping to take care of here.
Mr.
Vice Chair.
I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Wirth to vote on House Bill 2416.
Okay, members, we have is a motion to suspend the rules, allow Representative Wirth to vote on House Bill 2416A. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, rules are suspended. Representative Wirth, how do you vote on House Bill 2416A?
No.
I had to open a work session on that, wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. We got to open a work session on House Bill 2416A. Representative Wirth, how do you vote?
No, again.
Thank you. Representative Wirth votes no again. For the record.
We close the work session. Open the
House
vote
Bill 2416. Now we're going to reopen a hearing on House Bill 2893. Ray, tell us what this bill does.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair. First off, Representative Barnhart is on his way. And what House Bill 2893 does is modify the definition of public practice of the public practice of geology for the purpose of statutes relating to registered geologists to clarify that public practice must be for other persons for a fee or other compensation. And Mr. Chair, just so you and the committee knows, I wouldn't have said anything about the work session. We'd let that slide as the rules were suspended.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. All right.
And Representative Barnhart is here on his way to the microphone, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, doesn't he look great?
He looks great. He looks great. Rested, relaxed, ready to go back to work. Welcome, Representative. Good to see you again. Glad to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11 in Lane and Linn counties. And I'm very pleased to be here, and I hope that we are on House Bill 2893.
We are.
Oh, good. I'm in the right place for a change. I wanted to make a few comments about this bill. I sponsored the bill at the request of Mark Reed, who is a very well trained and expert person in the areas in which he testified in front of a public hearing in Lane County concerning the location of some of a gravel pit, and had a number of comments to make, which he can probably tell you more about, involving a report that was made in favor of the proposed pit, and he testified against it. As a result of his coming forward to present information, a complaint was made against him to the Board of Geologist Examiners, I think that's the name of it. The State Board of Geologist Examiners, on the grounds that he had violated the state licensing law for the practice of geology. He had made it clear to the Board of Commissioners that he was not a licensed geologist, although he had knowledge of geological structures and issues, and was and presented information to them to help them in their public responsibility of making a determination about the viability of the gravel pit. That's not something that I'm particularly prepared to talk about, although he might if you asked him. The point of this bill and the object of this bill is to prevent the Board of Geologist Examiners from attempting to muzzle persons who come forward to testify at public hearings and to present information to public bodies about concerning information a public body needs to make a valid decision about a public matter. It is not the purpose of this bill to promote the practice of geology by unlicensed people. It is not the purpose of this bill to allow non-licensed people to provide geological reports. Yes, thank you. That's my illness speaking.
I thought it was also your profession.
Thank you. It is not the purpose of the bill to allow persons who are unlicensed to provide legally required geological reports, which are required in many instances as the prima facie evidence that something which a developer desires to do can be done. It doesn't dispose of the matter, but it's necessary in many instances in order to get to the point of applying for a permit to do the work. The only purpose, as I understand it, for this bill is to make certain that members of the public are allowed to testify at these kinds of public hearings and gather the information necessary in order to testify without being later harassed before the Board of Geologist Examiners. I have to tell you frankly that I consider this a First Amendment issue. I think it's a very important public policy issue. It's one that the legislature ought to take very seriously. There may, in fact, be detailed problems with the bill that many people have claimed there are. I haven't been able to understand them in the same way that those other people have, but please listen carefully to those arguments and see if their amendments are needed in order to take care of that. But that's the gist of it and the point of it. I frankly would prefer that, to the extent that this issue also comes up with other licensing boards, that the same kinds of scrutiny were provided to them, but we simply didn't have time to get past to try to write some kind of a general statute to deal with that. I will say one other thing. Several years ago, another well-educated person in a similar situation was actually fined $1,000 for testifying in front of another county commission against a development that was to be built on a sand dune. The claim of the developer was that the substructure of the ground was sufficient to handle the construction. The person who came and testified and was later fined for practicing geology said no, in fact, it would not handle the structure. The substructure would not handle the construction that was to be proposed. And now, as I understand it, those buildings are in the process of being wiped or washed into the sea. Not only is it an important public matter from the standpoint of allowing people to testify in public hearings, it's also perhaps an important check on the accuracy of geological reports. I believe, one final statement, I believe that public bodies such as county commissions are perfectly capable are reviewing for themselves the credentials of the people who they see and the validity of the information those people provide to determine whether or not they want to pay attention to it. The question of a license or not having a license in the case of testifying in front of a county commission should not be the exclusion of the testimony. It should be what weight should the county commission give the testimony. Commissioners are very capable of determining what weight they should give that testimony. They don't need our help. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? How easy you get off today, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair, I'd like to call Mark Reed. Mark? Mark, are you here by yourself, or is anyone else you'd like to bring with you?
There are a couple of others who have accompanied me, at least one of whom would like to testify.
Okay, well, why don't you go ahead and start off, and then I'll just read down through the list then. Welcome, Mark, and for the record, state your name.
My name is Mark Reed, and I'm very pleased to be here today to address Chair Krupp and the committee. As you've just heard from Representative Barnhart, a basic outline of the situation that brings me here. I won't review all of that in detail, but I would like to explain a little bit more of the background of the circumstance that motivated me to try to do something about the statute that was the one that ended up getting me into a problem. Now, the essential problem is that the existing statute has been misinterpreted by the State Board of Geologists Examiners, certain aspects of it, the definition of public practice of geology in particular. And so that's the main thing that this bill addresses. While that's one main thing, a second main thing is an explicit statement about right to testify. Now, these points you will find in an amended version that I'll say more about in a moment. I'm a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Oregon. Before going to the University of Oregon, I was a mine geologist in Butte, Montana for 3 years in a copper mine there. And so my experience, my background, my specialty is mineral resources and also geochemistry. I do studies of geochemical processes in the earth. And as Representative Barnhart mentioned, I testified as a private citizen in the proceedings in Lane County. Now, my attention was drawn to this issue, the gravel pit issue that I testified for, mainly because it was a pit proposed for a region of prime farmland, class 1 and class 2 soils. And so that got my attention, and it was also about a mile from my house. But then once I got into reading the documents submitted by the gravel company in support of the gravel pit proposal, I found that there were serious errors in the geologic work and what I would call misrepresentations of some of the data. And as a citizen knowledgeable about geology, I felt it was my obligation to draw these to the attention of the county commission, which I did in public testimony. And incidentally, subsequently, a number of my criticisms were admitted by the consulting geologist for the gravel company. That is, he agreed that I was correct in some of my points. Now, as Representative Barnhart mentioned, as a consequence of my testimony, the gravel company filed a complaint with the State Board of Geologist Examiners, and I went before that board to answer for my testimony. I expected the board to dismiss this complaint on the grounds that I had a First Amendment right to speak. But I soon found out that that was not their view of it. And so I ended up going through quite a process, ultimately resulting in a lawsuit brought on my behalf by some pro bono attorneys. And ultimately we did secure the point that I did have the First Amendment right to speak, both under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and under Article 1, Sections 8 and 26 of the Oregon Constitution. Now, the State Board of Geologist Examiners dismissed the complaint against me, and they repealed their administrative rule that had been pertaining to public testimony. And that was, to me, a very important step. The remaining problem, however, is that even though the rule has been repealed, the law that it was based on is the same, and the language that was that rule originally was based on is still there. And this problem goes back to at least 1985, when the board, the then existing board, attempted to address this kind of issue in testimony, and then subsequently by allowing that public testimony would be permissible, but then 15 years later that was not the case. So the law has a problem, and that's what we're trying to address. Now, looking at page 2 of what I've handed you, I have a note there about House Bill 2893 amended. Obviously, I understand you have not received an amendment of that kind. This same bill has been was discussed yesterday, a similar bill yesterday in the Senate, and there are two amendments to the bill that have been presented there, one by myself and one by the State Board of College Examiners. Those amendments really get at the fundamental issues, and I would draw to your attention in the testimony I've attached there one of those amendments, the one that we propose. Now, the reason there are amendments is that we've worked very hard with the State Board of Geologists Examiners over the past many weeks to change the language in the bill so as to meet their concerns. And we've had meetings and ferocious email exchange and phone calls and personal conversations to try to resolve the differences between the State Board and myself in how this bill, this language should be worded. And we've come a long way. We're almost there. We're getting close. But we do have some very, at least one significant difference that we still need to address. I would mainly direct to point out on page 2 that the main features of the bill is we want to establish that public practice of geology, that which would require a license, be for another, that is on behalf of a third party. That's not explicit in the present bill. And the second main feature that we're concerned about is identified there as number 9, a person shall not be construed to publicly practice or to offer to publicly practice geology solely because the person testifies or prepares to testify in a public proceeding. So that's really the heart of the issue, and that's what Representative Barnhart addressed a moment ago. Now, I wanted to try to understand as best I could where the constitutional limits lie on this kind of testimony. Now, I asked Professor Garrett Epps of the Law School at the University of Oregon, who specializes in constitutional law, if he would review the language that we were proposing and address the specific question of testimony in a public proceeding, number one, and number two, the question, what are the legal limits within case law on one person speaking on behalf of a group of others? So citizens are addressing a proposal that's on the table before a county commission, say, and the citizens have been invited by the county commission to present opinions on the proposal on the table, and we can do it individually on our own behalf, or as another common event would be presenting testimony for a group, where the group might have a geologist who's part of the group, say, who would present an opinion. So the issue really was to address those kinds of situations. And I'd point out, I'm just going to quote a few points here for you from Professor Epps. He points out that the freedom of citizens to speak to the government about concerns in a public forum in which such comment has been invited is perhaps the single most strongly protected form of speech known to our system of free expression. By the way, Professor Epps' four-page opinion is in another key item of testimony that I handed to you earlier. And Epps makes an interesting point that I had not anticipated, that the Oregon Constitution in Article 1, Section 26, actually, that's the part that it deals with redress of grievances, petitioning a government for redress of grievances, also has a subsection that says that there should be no law that would restrain the inhabitants of the state from instructing their representatives. And Epps makes a point of it further strengthens the claim that citizens have a right to speak to their representatives in the way that we're addressing here. Finally, two more points on Epps' opinion. I won't read all this to you because you have it in front of you, but one of the things he makes a distinction about is the difference between working for another providing geologic services on that person's property on the one hand versus addressing a public body in a public testimony situation. And for that particular one, he makes the point that the central feature of that situation is that the material that's being addressed in the testimony is available for anyone to review and comment. And secondly, the agency or body, that being a county commission, has solicited the comments from the general public. And under those conditions, constitutional protections very clearly apply. And his last comment, and I'll read a small part of, is that it is further clear that no rule could forbid a group of citizens from seeking the help, advice, and public advocacy of another citizen learned in geology and from presenting testimony to the agency or body, regardless of that individual's training or lack thereof. To this point, the State Board of Geologic Examiners has not accepted that last language, particularly the part, the distinction between speaking on one's own behalf and speaking, an individual speaking for a group. And you'll see in their version of what the language they would like to see, they make a distinction by saying a person may speak on his own behalf, but that person, the implication is the person may not otherwise speak, say, for a neighborhood group or for another group. And my point here with Professor Epps' opinion is that any such speech has to be permitted, whether it's on your own behalf or for a group, in this condition where you're addressing a proposal on the table before a public body.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm just astounded at this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Reed, because then nobody can talk about anything. I mean, as a former teacher, I could not say that if I had a substitute teacher or someone else that they were not appropriately teaching phonics or phonetics.
Mm-hmm.
a doctor could not say this other physician's practice was less than professional. Mm-hmm. This is ridiculous, isn't it? And we're wasting all this time and money to do this when you have the right to say anything you want to say. Praise God, that's why we're over in Iraq right now.
Yet you're expressing the point of view I held at the beginning of this.
Well, I wish I'd have been there for you.
I did find out an interesting thing yesterday from Senator Menas in the committee we addressed yesterday. He pointed out that there's RS 171-525-530 that addresses this point for legislative committees. That is, there can be no restriction of the, involving licensing or any kind of penalty on the basis of testimony to a legislative committee such as this one. And what we're essentially, I wasn't aware of this before, of that rule, of that law, is asking that kind of concept to apply at the county level, at all levels of state government, where it's a public testimony circumstance. I just have one final comment, and then I'll conclude, and that is,
that's the kind of law you can get.
It's really, this is addressed on page 4 of my written testimony. There's an issue of public safety here. The goal of licensing of geologists is to promote public safety, and that's good. That's important. We need to license geologists to promote public safety. However, there can be a problem if the only ones who are allowed to speak are licensed geologists, and the advantage of having a free, a First Amendment right to address a public body without licensing helps assure that there will be critics of whatever proposal comes forward, and that's what happened in my case. I mean, I was critical, and there are others that you'll hear about more in a moment, perhaps, where criticism should have been brought forward but wasn't because of these restrictions. And that's a significant point. I think public safety is definitely enhanced by increasing criticism. Criticism in the general sense. I mean, comment on analysis of a proposal before a public body. And when it comes to technical scientific issues like what I deal with, it's particularly important and sometimes difficult for the decision makers to get competing points of view, different perspectives from a broad range of input, and in order to make a sound decision. And so that would be, I think, my concluding point is that a claim that irresponsible speakers will talk to their representatives and lead them astray, that could happen now and then, but I think on the whole it's almost certain to work the other way. almost the majority of the time. And as Representative Barnhart mentioned, I think that the existing process, the democratic process, county decision makers and whoever, city, whatever, judging for themselves the credibility of the speakers is what we have to rely on in this circumstance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Who doesn't like your bill?
A number of registered geologists don't like the bill. The ones, well, I don't want to try to characterize them too much. Among the ones who don't like it are the ones I criticized in Eugene, and others who think similarly. Their concern has been that that there is no mechanism, if I cannot be constrained by a state licensing board, there's no mechanism to prevent me from saying false statements, and then there's no way to control that, is to reprimand me. In the absence of a board that could reprimand me, that they're concerned that would be a problem. There, we just have to rely on the county commissioners to judge the credibility of credentials and speakers to deal with that. That's the only solution I can imagine. I guess I would also mention that in the long haul, scientific credibility depends on being honest and complete in one's scientific statements. And certainly, those who I work with in university. Scientific geologists who I work with are always. That's a principle that we follow. So, and I would guess that in the circumstances where crackpots and charlatans come into play, and that can happen. It's inescapable. We have to rely on the county commissioners or the decision makers to recognize them and discount their testimony as appropriate.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate your testimony. Thoughtful.
Thank you.
As it is. And Chair, I'd like to call Robin Hartman. Robin, are you here? Welcome. For the record, state your name again.
Okay, thank you. My name's Robin Hartman, and I come from Roseburg, and I'm glad you didn't call on me first because I'm usually the farthest away, but I don't like to kick things off. I'm representing Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, and our organization has over 1,000 members from around the state. And first thing, I'd like to thank the chairman for three or four things. One is for scheduling the bill right after we introduced it, and then for working with us to pull that off the schedule, and then give the examiner's board and Mark Reed some time to negotiate, because I think we're three or four words apart, and then for rescheduling it today as well, because I think that'll help. Thank you. Our organization has been around for about 30 years. We were established when the Beach Bill was enacted, and our goal is to protect the public access and public use of Oregon's beaches. Oregon Shores is dedicated to educating Oregon citizens to more effectively participate in protecting the coastal environment. And the main reason that we're interested in this bill is we've been in place for 30 years, and we've watched geologists who are not registered come forward on the coast and take a look at proposals for projects and point out some troubles with those. And we know of two folks who have received problems and fines, or had to sign a consent form that said they would no longer practice publicly practice geology because of their testimony in a hearing. So we decided a couple years ago to try to help our geologist friends that understand the coastal processes and who stand up for good use of coastal resources. And then Mark Reed's case came up. We followed it and then learned of his interest in working on the statute. What I'd like to just urge, I attended an Oregon State Board of Geologists Examiners meeting a couple months ago and listened to their discussion about Senate Bill 572 and House Bill 2893. And I heard some things. There was a lot of agreement in the room, and I left with both Mark and Karen Reed and others and thought, my gosh, it's really close. I can't believe it was going to be this easy. What I heard in that room was that there's need for a change in a statute. I heard that the focus should be narrowly on providing public testimony. Board member John Bolio came forward and stated that the closer we can focus to the changes on providing testimony, the closer we are to passage. I heard Bolio map out a plan for negotiating the language with Dr. Reed, and after that meeting, we all left just thinking that this thing's moving forward. And in the next month, over the last month and a half or so, language has been changing back and forth on email and in person, and there are only a few words difference. And yesterday there was a hearing in the Senate General Government Committee, and Senator Corcoran's direction to John Bolio and to Mark Reed was, let's work out those few words. And so I guess what I'm here today to ask you to do, Mr. Chairman and committee, is please try to urge these folks to continue to work out those differences and get something done. We would prefer making the changes that are in Mark Reed's amendment. And the main thing is under the what I've highlighted on my second page there in italics, the language that's our preferred language. But we'd, to be quite honest, be satisfied with some change that just protects public testimony, whether it's on your behalf of yourself or for others. So, again, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Robin. Members, questions? Wow, you got off lucky, too, today.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, I'd like to call David Michael. David, is there anyone else with you also that would like to testify? Sure. Come. Okay, very good. Why don't you ever come up also? Welcome, and for the record, state your name.
Thank you, Representative Kropp. My name is David Michael. I'm the chair of the Board of Geologist Examiners. I hope that we can do two things here. I hope we can answer all of your questions, and I hope that you'll indulge me just a minute of trying to, I'd call it save face, but I'd like to explain. I'm glad that all of you representatives have to be intelligent people to get where you are, because you know there's always another side to the story. And the truth is, I think that we were kind of tried in the media as the Board of Geologist Examiners, and I'd at the very least like to clear a bit of that up and then get into what we've done in the realm of trying to work together towards a real solution to this problem. I presented you with my own testimony. I'm not going to read that except for to say that what it is, and you can read it at your leisure, is an outline of the events in Mark Reed's case. And Dr. Reed represented it reasonably well, except we would probably not agree that we were trying to stop testimony. The Board of Geologist Examiners has, for many years, had the understanding that testimony was undoubtedly protected by the First Amendment. The question is, where is this gray area between testimony and the public practice of geology when someone does work to back up their testimony? And I would freely admit, as the chair, having gone through this learning experience with Dr. Reed's case, that we had that in the wrong place. We were trying to balance our requirement to interpret the statutes for geology licensing and First Amendment rights, and we were trying to balance that without quite enough insight into what First Amendment rights really protect and don't protect, and we were working with a rule and an interpretation of the rule in terms of how to apply that rule that we believed to be right in our understanding of what First Amendment rights were. We've learned a lot since those days, and what we tried to do was we tried to say, of course the testimony is okay, it's the work that we see which looks just like what a consultant would do for someone for hire, where we would be able to come in and say, on a complaint, we'd be able to come in and say the quality of this work is or isn't good enough, and you have a license and you know, get it together or don't keep working. And that we thought was our responsibility. And at this point, stepping sort of way back with all the experience that we've had, I think that is still our responsibility, because it's not so much that the statute is wrong. It's that we have the charge to not violate First Amendment with our statute and with our interpretation of that statute, and we have the charge to deal with in these complaints whether there is a transition beyond the point of just giving testimony into something that would be the practice of geology, the public practice of geology. So that, I think, will be the charge of this board in the future, regardless of any of the results of this, of the statutory changes that you see before you. To give the board's view, if you will, of what's gone on so far relative to the statute and or to the Senate bill and the House bill, I would like to give you this second amendment to the Senate bill. I hope it's all right that we didn't realize this was going to be called, and John Bolio, who prepared this, is in knee surgery at the time, or hip surgery, and it says Senate Bill 572. It's the same language as we would have amended and that we've worked with Mark Reed on. I would like to give that to you if that's acceptable, Representative Crawford.
Certainly.
This is the amendment language that Dr. Reed talked about being different from his, the dash 2. And I'm sure that you will see that this language is almost identical, and he did highlight the point that is different, and that is where we have at the very end of this number 9, on your own behalf. And just to give you an understanding of where this came from, how John Bolio, who, incidentally, John Bolio is the state geologist, he's ex officio on the board, and he's common in your grounds here with the politics of the state. So he was asked to try to bring the board's interest and Dr. Reed's interest together and see if we couldn't get language that would make the bill work. And that's where this comes from. This is something that our board didn't craft this language. We talked enough with John Bolio for him to be able to get there. This is language that largely came from our Attorney General's advice, and Susanna will present the Attorney General's opinion, our opinion relative to this topic. But this language that we have moved to was John Bolio's best attempt at trying to keep this pretty narrow so that we could say Mark Reed, his interests and his condition, his situation that he went through is satisfied, and to the best of our understanding, it's not going to be harder for the Board of Geologic Examiners to do what their role is, to still evaluate complaints against people who are publicly practicing geology, whether they are or aren't. And so this language was John's best attempt to stay narrow, and he wanted it to stay on this your own behalf, because that's exactly what Mark Reed had done. And so John's description to the Senate yesterday was that if we stay with this language, we have done what he was charged with doing, trying to get agreement between Dr. Reed and the board's understanding at this point, having learned a lot about this First Amendment. And to go broader, John described it as a slippery slope. And the whole idea is that from our counsel at the Attorney General's office, we believe that there is at least uncertainty and confusion. You'll see in Christine Schutz's testimony, written testimony to you, that she says that the law in this case is complex and confusing. And the point that we're trying to get at is if we kept it narrow, we thought it could go. At the end of my testimony, written testimony to you, you'll see that I don't recommend that we go forward with this. And I say that recognizing that it probably is somewhat politically unfavorable from the standpoint of I want to be seen as cooperating. I really have tried to cooperate from the very beginning, and I think I understand this issue. I don't think we need to change the statute in order to get what we need here. That's the reason I'm recommending that we not do this. We had a rule and an interpretation of the rule and how to apply the rule that was wrong, and we've taken the rule off the books. I think we probably could put a more correct rule that would read much like this statutory language into place and be assured that what happened to Mark Reed would never happen again. We actually never tried to get at Dr. Reed for his testimony. It was the incredible amount of reports that that really looked like geologic work to us and the public practice of geology that triggered our investigation. And, you know, the complaint wasn't dismissed immediately because of that. And we will be doing the same sort of thing if our rule and the guidance within the Board of Geologists is clearer, having learned all these things about how we should balance the First Amendment and the question of publicly practicing geology, the charge of our board. I believe that we can make this work without statutory change. So that's the reason that I've recommended not necessarily going to that distance. I don't think that it's the only way to solve this problem. In fact, I think it's probably not the simplest way to solve this problem. I do believe that the board is committed to working with Dr. Reed to the point that we have paid our legal counsel to try and work with stuff that we could work on this Senate bill and House bill. But I think there actually is an easier way to do it. I think it could go back to the Board of Geology Examiners and satisfy all of the constituents, all of the interested parties, and I believe we could get there without going to statutory change. So I'm not sure that's clear, but that's the reason that I'm opposed to it. Not that I think everything that has been said here about the First Amendment rights is incorrect. I believe that in Dr. Epps' paper that you've been given through Dr. Reed, that there is some pretty clear guidance to our board as to how to evaluate these things in the future, and I believe that's what we'll have to do regardless of what the statute says, changed or otherwise. I just don't think you need to do this. So that's kind of where I'm at in terms of saying that I'm opposed to it. I'm certainly not opposed to Mark Reed's testifying, and I hope that can be perfectly clear to you. What I don't think is it's necessary to do statutory change. I think we probably could write a rule that would be right where it needs to be and be done with this problem without going through a legislative process. Now, with that, I hope I've covered everything. I don't like to make notes. I do have, when you get to Mike Long's testimony, he wasn't able to come. He left me with this with his written testimony, and I would like to take one more minute to state the answer, if you will allow me, Representative Krupp, to your question as to who's opposed to it. Because yesterday at the Senate bill hearing, there were a half a dozen people that were opposed to it, and two that couldn't be here again today that asked me to express their opinion. So would it be all right if I told you that? Because it's not my opinion, but it's who they are and why they're opposed.
Mr. Chair.
Technical ruling.
Mr. Chair, from a technical standpoint, the Senate bill is a Senate bill. We're working on a House bill, and this amendment carries no weight, if you will, in terms of the House bill. It cannot be brought into the House bill in its current form. Nor can we go ahead and follow the instructions on it in terms of deletion and insertion and so forth, because it simply addresses a bill that this committee does not have before it. In terms of Senate testimony, from a technical standpoint, again, we're in front of a House committee, and any testimony before a House committee, of course, is anybody, any Oregonians or anybody's right in the world, because we're in an open process. In terms of testifying on a Senate bill before a House committee, it's not really germane to the issue unless it's couched in terms of looking at the House bill that's before us. And that's the nature of the bicameral legislature.
Okay, so the chair is going to rule that you can submit on behalf of someone else what they ask you to convey to this committee and nothing more.
Okay. Can I ask a question of what just went on there? I just want to make sure I understand it.
Free speech, right?
does that mean that the amendment that I just gave you that does have the Senate bill on it, even though it is exactly what it would be if it just had the House bill's name, does that mean that's meaningless?
Technically, yes.
Can we fix that in any way?
It would have to be submitted as an amendment to this House bill.
The only difference would be to draw a line through Senate bill and write the House bill number. It would be the same, and I'm sure that's all.
It would have to come from legislative counsel that way for it to be a document that we could accept.
I'm not sure I understand that, sir. It's if we would have changed the name on it to House Bill, then it would have been the same as what we sent to the Senate.
It is a matter of rule, yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, maybe I can clarify. In order for any amendment to be put into any House bill, it needs to go through our legislative attorneys and needs to get assigned to the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
It must have that House bill on it. It's not a case of somebody drawing a line through or not. It needs to be analyzed by our attorneys, even if it's the same language, purported to be the same language. It has got to directly reference the House bill in which it is proposed to be moved into. Without directly referencing that House bill which is proposed to be moved into, we have no amendments. So from a technical standpoint, there is no amendment before this committee. There's a concept.
Mm-hmm.
There's a conceptual amendment here, and the conceptual amendment, if the chair or anybody else would want to entertain it to legislative council, it would have to be put into legislative council as a conceptual amendment. Legislative council would have to go ahead and take a look at it in terms of the context of the House bill, which they have drafted, then assign some type of number, if you will, that would attach it to the House bill. So from a technical standpoint, it's much different.
I think I understand the point you're making. The only reason I say that about the lining out is that if we were to have just taken Senate bill off of it and put the House bill on it and given it to you today, it would have been okay. Is that correct?
No.
Then I am confused by it, but I guess I don't need to understand it either.
Or we'll talk about it later.
Okay. Yeah. I would only like to offer that in answer to your question of who's opposed, the original House bill, along with the original Senate bill, had language about forepay and things that have been beat out in the discussion that we've had back and forth with Mark Reed. Many of the geology community really resounded on that because they had horror stories of things that they knew of where people could use that, and it would be a real step back in public protection. So that was the context in which people were really opposed. So with that, I would say that the national chair of the Association of Engineering Geologists told me to tell you, at Scott Burns, he's a professor at Portland State University, he told me to tell you that he was opposed. And largely, I think that's because that language was so different than what you see in the amendments before you, the one that I guess you're going to consider conceptual, if I get that grace, and the one that Mark Reed presented. Those things have flushed out much of the things that people were concerned with. There is also language in the existing House bill that's not in the amendment, as I understand it, that had to do with state employees not having to be registered, and that raised a lot of concern from other state geo workers, engineers, and geologists. So with that, I would be done with my presentation.
Yes, thank you. My name is...
Can I just ask a question, please?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. I'm curious because you've apparently been in business a long time.
I work for the Department of Forestry and have for 20 years. Do you mean the Board of Geologists Examiners has been in business a long time?
I don't care.
Or me in general.
But you know what? I just want to mention, because I have to leave very quickly here. But and I'm sorry that I do, but. The schools are requiring my attention immediately on the budget issue. But I'm just curious of and worried about us getting in this situation of where professional people can no longer give their opinion, dear God, without a, concern for jeopardy. I mean, no, none of us would be here.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, a judge, a doctor, stopping alongside the road, no wonder.
I have complete sympathy for that, Representative Nelson.
I'm just wondering how on earth we're getting to this point where we would take a position against a fellow geologist who wanted to just give his God-given opinion, right to his opinion.
I'm
worried about this.
We never said that he couldn't give his opinion.
Well, let's don't.
That was,
and
we
let's
never
don't
did.
Ever do it.
That was never what
Goodness
we did.
Sake, then why are we over in Iraq if we can't even protect our own rights here? You know?
No, I do know.
And this is just
I fully agree
crazy
with
that.
Well,
me. an unnecessary should never have happened. Excuse me, I apologize. You understand.
I do understand. I think that
you really believe that, too.
Well, I do believe it, and I don't believe that we ever really did tell Dr. Reed that he couldn't testify.
Well, did he pay for his own bills for all this legal pain?
Representing Nelson.
Second question?
No.
I don't get a even ask that? Could someone else ask it?
Perhaps.
Okay.
I'm ready for the next witness.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gilman. My name is Susanna Knight. I'm the administrator for the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners. And yesterday, we were notified in advance that there was a hearing on the Senate side, and I had asked our board attorney to be present to give testimony about this, and she had prepared the page that I submitted with my cover letter so that you would have the opportunity to read her evaluation of the situation. So if you see my letter, you'll see her testimony attached, and I'm here to present that to you on her behalf. I'm also here to state that Dr. Bolio, state geologist, would have joined us today if he hadn't been in hip replacement surgery. We just became aware of this hearing late yesterday morning. Most geologists that were interested in this topic are self-employed, and numerous of those came yesterday from Portland, Bend, different places. Not much happened, and in general, they're not here today because of situations where they can't be away from work again. I think that it's important, and I'm sorry there's only two of you to hear what I have to say, but I do think it's important for you to understand that if you look at what David's presented to you, he showed you where the board went through much work in evaluating the situation that occurred in terms of the complaint, and that part of our evaluation involved consulting with our attorney to be sure that we were doing the right thing. And when you do that, it takes time and it takes money. And I'm sorry Representative Nelson isn't here to know how much the board spent, because the board spent a lot of money trying to make sure that they were doing things correctly. At this time, it would be good if the board had the opportunity to give input into the bill. They met in March when they had the public hearing on the rule that they permanently rescinded, and it's been since removed from the records. If there are statute changes coming to the board statute, they usually plan on those for 12 to 18 months in advance and evaluate them and make sure everything's correct. And I would like to see them have the opportunity to do that with this bill, too. And they won't meet again until their June meeting. But if you refer it back to them, they certainly will go to work to address it in the next legislative session if there's an issue there that does need to be addressed. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions the two of you might have.
Thank you. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to ask on behalf of Representative Nelson. She asked me to ask the question, and I'm not sure I understood it, but whether or not the bill had to be paid by the doctor. How was it? How did you understand the question? Whether or not he had to pay his bill?
I think she was asking if he had to pay his legal fees.
Okay.
We did not fine him at all. And I understood that work was pro bono, but I guess you could ask Mark himself.
Okay. Well,
and he already testified that
it was pro bono.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Maybe she didn't understand. I hope I asked the right question.
He paid, but it was a $25,000 cost to the attorney.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Representative
Gilman? I'd like to make a statement.
Okay.
We have agencies that take the laws that we enact and make rules. And I am of the opinion that oftentimes they err in the rules mm-hmm. they make. And that's really all I want to say, but I want you to keep that in mind, whether this bill goes ahead or not. Mm-hmm. Whenever you decide to make the rules, and I'm sure you will, mm-hmm. for the whatever you're going to do as to sanctions to individuals.
Yeah, I recognize that we made an error, not the particular board that's in place now, but the rule that was there that we rescinded was an error.
Okay. If you want this bill to go forward, you're still going to have to clean up a few little problems. It sounds like it's just a couple of words away. I'm going to have to ask you to do it because we're getting close here. And if it doesn't happen pretty soon, the bill probably will die because it won't come out of committee. Thank you for your testimony.
Oh, and they didn't call Mike Long, who had signed up, and I have his written testimony.
Right, and you mentioned it, and I already marked him off. So I can go ahead and hand it in. Yes. Yes. Anyone else to testify on 2893? I close the hearing on 2893, and we're adjourned.